Welcome. It's nice to have you here. I'm so glad you could come. This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it. I think you will.
Clearly, folks, we're in some tough economic times. But finally, after months and months of dark clouds, there is some good news.
A stunning turnaround by the banking giant Goldman Sachs.
$3.4 billion in earnings in the past 3 months' time.
Goldman Sachs is on track to pay out as much as $20 billion in bonuses, $700,000 per employee, more than 14 times the average American household income.
Woohoo! We're back! Yes! You hear that? That is the sound of raw capitalism stampeding. Goldman Sachs makes $3.4 billion in profit from April to June. I guess the bailouts are working for Goldman Sachs. How is it happening? Well, it's simple. Let me explain. The U.S. economy is basically a pyramid. And it's taken some real hits lately. Unemployment is at a 26-year high. 6.5 million jobs have been lost. 1.9 million house foreclosure filings just this year. And consumer confidence is at an all-time low. All economic indicators that have left the beloved top of our pyramid, the I, Goldman Sachs, in peril. Because everyone who studies pyramids knows you must always protect the pyramid's eye. Pyramids can survive the loss of the foundation, but once they get poked in the eye... Anyway, that's where the government came in. First, they let a couple of Goldman Sachs' competitors, like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, collapse or be absorbed. That can't be bad for Goldman's business. Then, we gave AIG $13 billion so they could pay back, 100 cents on the dollar, the $13 billion they owed Goldman Sachs for the bets Goldman Sachs had made that AIG insured. Then we let Goldman Sachs become a holding bank and gave them $28 billion in loan guarantees to keep their cost of capital down. It's what's known in business as the invisible government-funded scaffolding of the free market. And it worked! Just enough for Goldman Sachs to pay its employees a total of $11.36 billion so far this year. So fret not, America! Your work has not gone in vain. We can all rest assured that... Wait, what's happening? Is there... No, the supports are giving out! Quick! Everybody, throw your bodies under Goldman Sachs to cushion its fall! Children first! They're the softest!
You get nothing! You lose! Good day, sir!
Gonna rise up, take what's there. 'Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting July 20th is produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Thanks to the Slingshot organizer, the Daily Bleed website, and the Radio Roots crew from WBAI in New York for supplying material you're about to hear.
Little surprises around every corner, but nothing dangerous.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
Week in Radical History for July 20th, we only have a couple items. 1848, the Declaration of Sentiments begin the women's suffrage movement in New York. Also on July 20th, 1874, General Custer and his first official exploration expedition enters the Black Hills with 150 wagons and 1,000 men in direct violation of the Treaty of 1869 that barred whites from the Sacred Hills. Treaties? What treaties? We're the U.S. government. We don't abide by any treaties. Also on July 20th, 1944, German officer plots to kill Adolf Hitler and stage the coup. Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg left a briefcase concealing a bomb at Hitler's feet during a meeting. The bomb killed four people, but a table leg shielded Hitler. Also on July 20th, 1997, Honduras, announcement of more mass graves of leftists found in military sites by the U.S.-backed government. Lastly, on July 20th, 2001, Carlo Gallini, a 23-year-old Italian activist and anarchist, dies during a demonstration against the G8 summit in Genoa. Gallini was killed in a clash between protesters and Italian military police, who shot him and then ran over his body with a jeep. This week in radical history, starting July 21st, 1916, U.S. Marines land in Haiti again to protect American interests. They'll go back again and again as well, the U.S. having a lot of interest to protect.
The men and women in our armed forces protect our borders and our people, not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita Banana, Exxon, and Halliburton. These are not isolated incidents of stupidity. They're part of a long, bloody history of foreign policy being conducted for the financial interests of the wealthy few.
Also on July 21st, 1954, the Geneva Accords are signed, ending the French colonization of French Indochina, a place also known as Vietnam. The U.S. discovering that the French might not be interested, but by God, the U.S. must have some special interest in Vietnam. Within a year, they'll have our first military advisors setting the stage for the Vietnam War. Also on July 1st, 1972, George Carlin is charged with disorderly conduct for performing his famous Seven Words Act in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
There are two things that I blame for the abysmal condition of this magnificent species that had such potential at one time, and that is religion and commerce. And those are the two things that hinder us here. I mean, the religious people say this is immoral, it is corrupting, and it will do bad things to your character if you even hear these words as a child or a grown-up or whatever. And commerce says if you say these things, the customers and the advertisers are going to run from you.
This week in radical history for July 22nd.
On this day, July 22nd, in 1863, American frontiersman Kit Carson was ordered by the military governor of New Mexico to get rid of the entire Navajo Nation. At first, Carson was shocked by the brutal nature of this plan and attempted to resign his position. But after being pressured to stay, he obediently began the forced removal of the Navajo people from their land. First, Carson and his men implemented a scorched earth policy, burning Navajo fields and homes and stealing their livestock. Carson then began attacking the Navajo strongholds that fought in resistance until the Navajo were forced to surrender. A few months later, 8,000 Navajos were forced to march 300 miles to Fort Sumner, where they were imprisoned for the next 4 years. Over 300 people died during the long walk, and many more died in imprisonment. This is just one of the many brutal atrocities committed against indigenous populations in the land of the free.
Also on July 22, 1938, Joe Louis defeats German boxer Max Schmeling. Because of the Nazi persecution of the Jews in Europe and Hitler's disdain for blacks, the fight had a mystic proportions, with Louis seen by many as fighting to uphold democracy and the race. He succeeded convincingly, ending the fight in the first round. Also on July 22, 1970, during the Alcatraz occupation by Indians of all tribes, the first child was born on the first freed Native American piece of land in the 20th century. Also on this date in 1995 in Israel, four foreign activists break padlocks and reopen the main gates to the Palestinian Hebron University in the West Bank, closed by Israeli security and occupation forces back in 1987.
On this day, July 23rd, in 1846, writer and philosopher Henry David Thoreau was thrown in jail for refusing to pay his $1 poll tax in protest of American slavery and the Mexican-American War. Thoreau had resisted his poll tax for 6 years because he did not support the government's use of the money. Although he was only in jail for one night, the experience deeply impacted him, and he began speaking out about the responsibility of individuals to hold their government accountable. 3 years later, Thoreau wrote Civil Disobedience, an essay explaining how the actions of the American government were controlled by only a few individuals rather than the people. Thoreau's essay was highly influential to many activists.
Also on this day, July 23rd, 1892, strikers battle Pinkerton thugs during the Carnegie Steel Strike in Homestead, Pennsylvania, as the Pinkertons, trying to import and protect scabs, open fire on striking steel workers. In the ensuing battle, three Pinkertons and 11 Strikers and spectators are shot dead. Strikers militantly resisted the private goons hired by Henry Clay Frick to dislodge him from the plant grounds. They fought back with guns and homemade cannon. The strike, however, lasted for 4 months, but the company was able to restore production as winter approached and morale declined. Anarchist Alexander Berkman, on this day, would enter Frick's office and shoot him, trying to revenge the deaths of the strikers. As a side note, later in the year, Emma Goldman would horsewhip her old mentor, Johann Maust, for shit-talking Berkman's attempt. She horsewhipped him on stage and broke the whip afterwards. Also on July 23, 1908, Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semite Henry Ford would sell his first Model T. On July 30, 1938, Hitler presented the highest non-citizen award, Grand Cross, the Supreme Order of the German Eagle, to Henry Ford in Berlin. U.S. Senate reports in 1974 on Ford Motor Company's aid to Nazi war effort. Have you driven your Ford in support of the Nazis lately? Also on July 23, 1967, starts out of Detroit upheavals, 7 days of social unrest, fighting with cops, anti-business, anti-government actions, including looting, results in 43 dead, 2,000 wounded, and 5,000 made homeless. Largest U.S. riots in a century, sparks additional riots throughout the United States. Also on this date in 1968, police kill 7 in standoff with black nationalists in Cleveland, Ohio, triggering days of riots and 4 more deaths. Lastly, on July 23, 2004, preemptive harassment as FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force investigate info shops and anarchists throughout the country. In Lawrence, Columbia, Kirksville, Topeka, and St. Louis, agents serve several anarchists with subpoenas, ordering them to report to the grand jury on the same day they were planning to go to Boston to protest the Democratic National Convention. Let freedom ring. This day in radical history for July 24th, labor organizer Mary Harris, Mother Jones, begins the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Theodore Roosevelt Summer Hole in Oyster Bay, Long Island, New York, to publicize the harsh conditions of child labor in Philadelphia textile mills. When Mother Jones first visited Philadelphia, she found child workers as young as 10-year-old with stooped shoulders and missing fingers and hands. In response, she organized the march. Mary Harris, Mother Jones, led striking children from Kennington Textile Mills in Pennsylvania on a 17-day march from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, where they hoped to confront Roosevelt in his summer home. About 300 men, women, and children were led by 3 children dressed as Revolutionary War soldiers. Along the way, they raised awareness of child laborers with rallies in eastern Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, and won the hearts of many. When Mother Jones and her army arrived in Coney Island, she was asked to speak. The result of the speech was The Wail of the Children, which was delivered today. When they reached Oyster Bay on July 29th, where Teddy Roosevelt was vacationing, he refused to see them. Our beloved Teddy Roosevelt would be quoted as saying, "The worst foe of the poor man is labor leaders, who tries to teach him that he is the victim of conspiracy and injustice." Of course, the children would have problems reading these reports in the newspapers, since they're often kept illiterate and had no fingers for turning the pages. Also on this day, July 24th, 1925, John T. Scopes, convicted in Tennessee of teaching evolution in high school, fined $100 and cost for monkeying around. Also on this date in 1950, German V-2 became the first rocket to be launched at Cape Canaveral, Florida. Big surprise, as the U.S. provided safe haven for thousands of Nazis following World War II, including known war criminals and hundreds of scientists who developed the Nazi-German rocket program. In the U.S. intelligence, there was no prohibition for hiring anyone in the Gestapo or SS, historians said. This was a don't-ask-don't-tell culture. Also on this date in 1974, House Judicial Committee debates Nixon's articles of impeachment, including obstruction of justice, abuse of presidential powers, using CIA, FBI, and IRS and other federal agencies to violate civilian constitutional rights and to create the Plumbers Group to engage in illegal acts, as well as failure to supply subpoenaed material to the committee. Failure to turn over subpoenaed materials. Same crimes, different times. Lastly on this date in 1983, women tag U.S. warplanes with graffiti at Greenham Commons in England. This week in Radical History for July 25th, 1648 in New World, York County Court upholds authority of colonists to kill on site any free Indians they see in settled areas. Also on July 25th, 1930, a white mob threatens to hang ranchers employing Filipinos in Washington, Filipinos being the Mexican of their time, or the Irish before them, or the Polish before them, or the Chinese before them. Just pick your wave of immigrants you vilify and marginalize. Also 1946, the crime, 2 young black couples are killed by a lynch mob at Moore's Ford Bridge over the Apache River. The 4 were tied up and shot hundreds of times in broad daylight by unmasked men. Murder weapons included rifles, shotguns, pistols, and machine guns. The Tuskegee Institute newspaper called it a lynching. The cover-up. Despite the intense investigation by the FBI, the killers remain free. The best people in town won't talk, says Georgia State Patrol officer, on the climate of fear and threat of retaliation that discourages law-abiding citizens to cooperate with the investigation. Again, in 2005, there was another attempt to bring the survivors of the mob to justice, but that failed as well. No justice, no peace. Also on the state in 1969, proving how everyone is equal in the United States, Senator Edward M. Kennedy drives a car in which Mary Jo Capaci is killed earlier in the week, receives a 2-month suspended sentence for leaving the scene of an accident, however nothing for killing Mary Jo.
On this day, July 25th in 1972, the Washington Star exposed the story of the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, a cruel medical study that the U.S. Public Health Service had been conducting on 399 poor black men for the last 40 years. The men, who were in the late stages of syphilis and lacked access to proper health care, were not in a position to deny this supposedly free treatment. They were never told that they had syphilis and were actually left untreated while slowly dying from the degenerative disease. The experiment had continued despite the World Health Organization's 1964 declaration that informed consent was mandatory for experiments involving human beings.
Also on this date, 1983 in Nicaragua, the American right-wing funded Contras torture and kill 15 at San Francisco del Norte. Reagan compares the Contras to the nobility of Abraham Lincoln. Also on this date in 1990, U.S. Ambassador Applegate tells Iraq President Hussein that the U.S. won't take sides in Iraq-Kuwait dispute, or perhaps it will invade and start the first Gulf War. It's one or the other. Also on this date in 1993, Lebanon. Israeli begins blasting targets in southern Lebanon. 130 die by the end of the month. 500,000 civilians flee the bombardment. Tune in again in 2006 as Israel and Hezbollah go at it. Lastly on this date, in 2001, Bush administration, high on image, short on principle, rejects the draft treaty on enforcement of biological weapons ban. Saddam can't have them, but we sure can. This week in Radical History for July 26, 1860, Norton I declares the United States dissolved, turns over temporary powers to state governors, and declares himself emperor. This one-time very rich land speculator living in San Francisco even issues the Imperial of Norton Treasury notes from 50 cents to $20 denominations. Also on this date in 1874, the U.S. orders friendly Indians are to remain in fixed camps in Wichita Agency, Oklahoma, Indian Territory, and answer periodic roll calls to stop any possibility of them moving around freely. Also on this date in 1877, 30 workers killed at the Battle of Viaduct by federal troops in Chicago. The Battle of Viaduct, U.S. troops and 2nd Militia Regiments and police attack about 5,000 workers at Halstead and 16th Street in Chicago, Turner Hall raid. Police raid the hall during the meeting of the German furniture maker, killing one and wounding many. A judge later finds that the police are guilty of preventing the workers from exercising their right of freedom of speech and assembly. A grim reminder that the true function of police in the Army is not issuing traffic tickets, paying officer-friendly, or defending the shores of terrorism, but keeping its own citizens in line and the nation workers docile in the need of political and business powers that be. That editorial from the Daily Bleed website.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone. And welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. One of the great horrors of the Israeli occupation of Palestine is the brutal treatment of children by the Israeli military. This morning we get a vivid look at the abuse of Palestinian children by the Israeli military through the eyes of Ivan Karakashian, who represents Defense for Children International Palestine, an organization which defends children caught up in the Israeli military courts. These are Palestinian children. Israeli children, when arrested, are processed in the Israeli civil court process, never in military courts. Just the opposite is true of Palestinian children. They are only processed in the military courts, and you are about to hear the difference. Here is Ivan Karakashian of Defense for Children International Palestine, speaking to a group from Boston visiting Israel-Palestine through the Grelta Foundation.
So just to start, Defense for Children International Palestine is a, we have the word international in our name, but we're very much a local Palestinian NGO. We belong to the worldwide movement, Defense for Children International, but each section is autonomous in terms of its funding and programming, and we don't really report to the central office. In that way, we're really more of a franchise than a branch office. And then the majority, we were set up in 1991 by Rafat Qassis, who himself was in prison for about 6 months, and during his prison term, he realized that children in the military courts and the military detention system were being kept with adults, and realized that children weren't receiving any kind of special protections and their special needs weren't being met. So immediately upon his release, he established Defense for Children International Palestine in 1991 as a strictly legal aid organization for children in distress, and specifically children encountering the military court system. And then in the year 2000, we expanded and we started documenting all violations committed by the Israeli side against Palestinians living in the occupied Palestinian territory. And then in the year 2005, we expanded yet again and began representing children in Palestinian courts accused of Palestinian crimes, as well as documenting violations against children by the Palestinian Authority and by the Palestinian groups. And it's at that point that we became a fully fledged children's rights organization. We're currently the only considered local Palestinian children's organization operating. Some of our key funders and donors and people we work with regularly would be Save the Children, UNICEF, the United Nations Development Program. We're also funded by a few European governments like Sweden, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and several church groups and faith-based communities both in the U.S. And in Europe. So that's DCI. Then really what my talk will focus on is the Israeli military detention system and what it's doing, because you're about to go encounter that, all of you, with the exception of Steve. Apologies again. But then we'll move on to some of the recent violence that we've witnessed against Palestinian children. And then if you guys have questions also about some of the violations on the Palestinian side, I'd be more than happy to answer some of those. And I'll explain the difference in our advocacy at some point between working with the Palestinian side versus the Israeli side. But the first thing that I hope you've heard by now is that in the West Bank, there are two legal systems operating. One applies to all Palestinians since 1967 in its military law, and that applies to everyone, adults, children alike. And the other is Israeli civilian law, which applies to the all settlers living in the West Bank. That, to me, didn't come into complete clear view until I realized what it meant in practice. And in practice, what it means is the Israeli army is here to impose military law, whereas it is not there to administer civilian law. So if you had a group of young Jewish settlers clashing with a group of young Palestinians, the Israeli army has the authority to arrest the young Palestinians, but has no authority to arrest the young Jewish settlers because they belong under civilian law, and only the Israeli police should be arresting the Jewish settlers. So essentially what you end up, and then Moreover, some of the crimes that exist under, or offenses that exist under military law, don't exist under the civilian legal system. And so a Palestinian could be committing crime while a Jewish settler could be doing the exact same act and not be committing that crime. And so one person would get arrested, the other wouldn't. And those are just, you know, there's real discrimination that exists in that system and how it applies to Palestinians. Israel is the only country in the world that systematically prosecutes and convicts somewhere between 500 to 700 children every year in military courts. That's the case that we've been documenting that since at least 2000, that number specifically. And then within the within that number, we find that children during the arrest in the first 24 to 48 hours experience all kinds of abuse and violations of their rights. And that's when the arrest process begins. So the majority of children are arrested between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. The reason Israeli soldiers arrest, or the reason they say they arrest children between midnight and 5 a.m. is because if they arrested them in the middle of the day, they'll say it'll cause more clashes and be more dangerous to all sides, so it's easier to come in the middle of the night and arrest these children. That is kind of like a false choice, because the other thing that they could do is they could summon children to appear for questioning. And that's something that Defense for Children International Palestine raised and UNICEF through UNICEF to the Israeli authorities, and they began piloting a summons system to ask children to come in for questioning. But they haven't kept up any data about how the summons process was going, and they haven't told anyone where they're applying this pilot program and whether they're still applying it or not. It's unclear to them.
So they're not arresting children who are out on the streets in these hours. They're going to their homes.
What happens is, a lot of the times, if there's a sort of a protest or a clash mm-hmm. taking place, from the military watchtowers, you'll have like soldiers taking photographs of all the people in the area, and then they'll go in later that night to see, you know, they'll have sort of an idea of what the children, their ages, and who lives in each area, and they'll have their ID numbers, and they'll go into the house seeking the same ID number and then comparing it to the photo they took earlier in the day. Oftentimes, but they're taking photos not necessarily of children throwing stones or in the act of an offense, but really just any and everyone in the area. So it'd be a lot of children on rooftops watching what's going down on the street, and those guys will get snapped up first. In fact, the rate of free arrest is extremely high, because it's the same children that live next to the same military watchtower that are repeatedly getting their photos taken, repeatedly getting picked up for questioning. So when these children, but with the summons process, just so I could wrap up with that, essentially what Israel did for a while was they would send units of soldiers to their home. They would raid the home in the middle of the night, carry out all the exact same violations, but before leaving at 3 or 4 a.m., leave a piece of paper in Hebrew saying, you know, we're summoning you for questioning the next day at 8 a.m., and then leave. And then once the dad brought the child at 8 a.m. for questioning, he would be immediately separated from his child, and the child would then go through the exact same abuses he was going through afterwards. So while we believe the summons process would help stop a lot of these violations, the way it's being applied is not in good faith by the Israeli authorities. But to just quickly describe the experience of a child being arrested in the middle of the night, usually what happens is you have a unit or two of soldiers raiding the home. You know, we hear sometimes between 14 to 18 soldiers come to the home. They'll raid the home. They'll go in. They'll start destroying furniture as they search the entire house. We've had some children wake up in their bedroom in their pajamas, only to find about 5 soldiers surrounding them, aiming their machine guns and telling them to get up very quickly with them. Of course, when that happens, something very quickly happens to the child psychologically, which is the child realizes that his home isn't a safe place, that his room doesn't offer any kind of privacy or safety. And more importantly, he realizes that his parents are powerless to protect him. When soldiers show up to arrest children, they don't have to show you, they don't have to tell or inform the parents where the child is being taken or why the child has been arrested. They just say, we need to take this child, he's done something wrong, and they take him. So essentially, for a certain period of time, depending on the age of the child disappears in a sense, where the parents don't know exactly where that child's being taken or why he has been taken. If the child is 12 or 13 years old, it's usually about 24 hours. If he's 14 and 15, it's 48 hours that he disappears. And if he's 16 or 17, it's up to 96 hours that they don't really know where he is.
Yeah. How often is this going on with how many kids?
So it's estimated around this year that it would be around 1,000 kids, 1,200 kids.
Yeah, three times a day.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And is that happening?
And then, but there's a big difference between children they detain and children they arrest. Mm-hmm. They detain far more children than they arrest children. So during clashes, like you were asking, you know, are these the children? They might detain a lot of children during clashes, but they'll let them go within 2 to 3 hours or maybe up to 6 hours. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they won't charge them with anything. With arrested children, it's the ones that end up being convicted in military courts, and that's where the 500 to 700 number estimate comes in.
And this is happening in the West Bank?
This is specifically in the West Bank.
Israel proper?
It's not. The military
doesn't operate there.
It doesn't operate, and the military law doesn't apply to Israeli civilians. And also, even though it applies in the West Bank, it doesn't apply to Jewish settlers living in the West Bank. So it only applies to Palestinians in the West Bank. Yeah, it also doesn't apply to Palestinians living in East Jerusalem because Israel considers the entirety of Jerusalem its undivided capital and therefore applies civilian law to everyone, including East Jerusalemites, who tend to be all Palestinians. But within the civilian legal system and civilian criminal law, there's a lot of discrimination. So even though Palestinians living in East Jerusalem have that these protections in theory, when they show up before a judge, they'll face a lot of discrimination the way the judge administers the law to them in East Jerusalem. And so what happens with these children is then they're immediately blindfolded. The Israeli army puts plastic hand ties on their wrists, often so tightly that when our lawyers catch up with these children a few days later, they'll still find the markings of the plastic cord. And then the children are placed on the metal floor of the military jeep. And that's usually when the physical violence begins. Between the years 2012 and 2015, we collected 429 affidavits in equal numbers from children, and about 75% of all those children suffered some form of physical violence at the hand of the arresting officers and throughout the interrogation, that first 24-hour period. What's important is once they've been arrested, they no longer pose a threat. And so to suffer violence after you no longer pose a threat is a particular violation of their rights. We've had children being slapped, kicked, punched. The soldiers will use the butts of their rifles against these children. In some extreme circumstances, we've had soldiers extinguish cigarette butts on the lips and the arms of the children. We've had one case where a soldier had an empty beer bottle that he smashed on the head of one of the children. So abuses vary while you're en route being transferred to a military base. And because these children are being arrested in the middle of the night, the interrogator is typically not ready to interrogate these children because he's sleeping. And so the children will get moved around from military base to military base until it's time for their interrogation period. Throughout that time, children are sort of kept blindfolded, except every time they go from one military base to the next, they are strip searched, they meet a doctor, asks them some very common questions and doesn't even care what they answer. But they strip search the children every time they go through to a military base. And then they'll let them get dressed again, put back the blindfolds, put back the hand ties, They won't bring the children any food or water or access to toilets. And if the child asks for any of those three things, you could expect more abuse. And in the military bases, we've also recorded several instances where they'll let children into a small room with the military dogs, and they know Palestinian children are specifically scared of these dogs. And just anything to sort of frighten the child. By the time the child shows up to interrogation, he's gone through something like 12 hours where the trauma started at home. He was beaten up on the way to the military bases. His parents have no idea where he was taken or why he was taken. He's feeling completely alone. It's been 12 hours of this abuse, and then he's brought into an interrogation room with a very professional interrogator wanting to get a confession out of that child. If the child doesn't immediately confess, and then children in the military, under military law, have really two rights only: the right to remain silent and the right to consult an attorney prior to the interrogation. They're under military law not allowed to have the attorney present during the interrogation or to have a parent present during the interrogation.
They can consult an attorney before interrogation, but not during.
But they can't have the attorney sitting with them during the interrogation. Okay. Yeah. And then in fact, in 97% of cases, they're denied consulting with an attorney prior to interrogation. So even though they have that right, it's denied to them in about 97% of cases that we documented from those 429 affidavits. Moreover, the children, even though they're sort of, we used to say that children aren't informed of their rights at all. So now there's a piece of paper that they present the children with Arabic and Hebrew stating those two rights, and they force the children to sign this piece of paper. But often the children don't have the time to read, and even if they read, the interrogators don't ask the children whether they've properly understood their rights. And they're just asked to sign it, and the paper's taken away. And that way, when we come and say they're not informed of their rights, they can present that piece of paper and say, look, he signed it, you must know his rights. So now we say that children aren't properly informed of their rights to a level where they understand them and can apply them. And then during the interrogation, if the child doesn't cooperate with the interrogator, then you'll expect, you know, the old phone book, or the interrogator will bring in a baton and hit the child with it. And you'll get all kinds of physical violence, shaking, slapping on the ears to disorient the child. Throughout the interrogation, the child is handcuffed and shackled to a small metal chair in uncomfortable positions. So there's quite a lot of position abuse and rising the use of position abuse while interrogating these children. And then if the child still doesn't cooperate after that level of physical violence is applied, then they'll start using psychological violence, and specifically the use of solitary confinement against children. Here, solitary confinement is used in a way that's very different than the way it's used in the U.S. In the U.S., if solitary confinement is being used against a child, it's usually after the child has been convicted of a crime. And if he steps out of line while serving a sentence, they might use solitary confinement as a punishment. Oftentimes you'll hear the argument in the U.S. that it's to protect the child, and so they want to separate him from a particularly hostile group of people, or they don't have the facilities to separate him from adults, so they'll place him in solitary confinement. In the Israeli context, a child is placed into solitary confinement before he's been even charged with a crime. So and they'll put a child into solitary confinement until the child is ready to confess to wrongdoing, so that they could then charge the child with that wrongdoing. We've had this year a rise in the number of solitary confinement cases. There are about 17% of children are put through solitary confinement. This was for this year's statistics. That translates to, out of the 158 cases we document, well over, I think, 25 or 26 were placed into solitary confinement this year from the cases that we documented. The longest period that a child spent in solitary confinement this year was 29 days. So 29 days in a cell that's about the size of one and a half of these tables. So it's a very small cell.
Yeah.
From here to here, yeah. And it has no windows. There's a small open slit at the top of one of the walls that lets in cold air. And in the summer, it doesn't let in enough cold air. And in the winter, it lets in too much cold air. Yeah.
A child that would be kept in solitary for that length of time, would that be someone, you know, 16, 17?
The majority are 16 and 17. We've had a few 15-year-olds also.
But not the little kids who are pulled in?
No, it'd be seldom that a 14 or 13-year-old would be put in.
So 15 and over, probably.
15 and over, yeah. I would say the vast majority, yeah. And then there's a yellow dim light that's kept on 24 hours so that the child doesn't know what time of day it is. There's a small, thin mattress for the child to stay on. And because there are protrusions coming out of the wall, it makes, makes it difficult for the child to lean up against any of the walls. So he has to stay in the center of the room. And the only human contact he has is when he's brought out intermittently for interrogation or when the flap in the door is opened and his fruit tray is brought in. And then, you know, we even had this one 17-year-old last year spent about 45 days in that condition. And according to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, if an adult spends anything, any time longer than 2 days, it's tantamount to torture. So if you can imagine someone under the age of 18 spending 45 days, 29 days, and at that point, the child hasn't done anything wrong. They haven't charged the child. You know, he's presumed innocent and yet thrown into solitary confinement.
I said, are they, when they're in solitary, they're no longer blindfolded or wristbound, right?
No, they're no longer blindfolded or wristbound.
Why would they hold somebody in solitary for so long if there's no charges? Wouldn't that be a waste of resources, or is there some other...
It's to force the child to confess.
To something, even if they haven't been charged for X number of days, like 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah, they have the ability to not charge the child for up to, I think, 55 days. And so they could keep you there under suspicion, but you have to appear before a military court judge to get sort of reviewed. And so sometimes if they've put you in solitary confinement, the interrogator will appear before a military court judge, explain the extenuating circumstances, and ask for more time in interrogating the child.
It sounds like a false confession. Why would they want a false confession?
It is a false confession. That's the point that I'm getting to. Yeah, a lot of these confessions are what we would consider coerced confessions that should be immediately thrown out from the courts. Even the cases that don't involve solitary confinement but involve physical violence during the interrogations or other types of duress should immediately be thrown out. Unfortunately...
Yeah, but why would they want that, though?
Why would they
want... Why would they, I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, why would they want forced
confession?
Because the military judges accept it. They never question these. They don't throw out these forced confessions.
But why would they want a conviction based on a forced confession?
It's a good question, yeah. So just to let you know, the military court system has a 99% conviction rate.
Yep.
And so they convict... everyone. Why are they convicting these children specifically? And why are they arresting through convicting these children, putting them through the military court system? We believe it's, you know, when you hear courts, you think courts administer justice, but we believe that in this case, the military courts administer control over a population.
So that's the ultimate goal.
And that's the ultimate goal. If you have children, which is the most vulnerable demographic of Palestinian society, and you put them through these horrific conditions of the military court system, then you ensure that the rest of the population stays in control.
So they want control over them, and this is a...
They want to put fear...
because ultimately they want to...
That's how they sustain the overall occupation, you know, there's... It's also similar to some of the... You guys went to Hebron already?
Yes.
Yeah, so in Hebron, we speak... I went on a few speaking tours with Breaking the Silence, which is a group of former Israeli soldiers that have decided to talk about what their experiences have gone through. And one thing that one of those soldiers mentioned while I was speaking to him was that there are small units of soldiers controlling a population in the hundreds of thousands in Hebron. So how do you get, you know, 20, 30, 40 soldiers managing to control a population of several hundred thousand?
And that control is all ultimately about possession of the land.
possession of the land, but how do you get, like, how do you get Palestinians wholesale not to protest and go out in the streets and then kill all 40 soldiers, because 100,000 people could effectively manage to overtake 40 soldiers?
That's what they said in Nabi Salah, that they stopped the demonstrations because all of the kids between 10 and 15 or whatever had all been arrested. And
arrested,
basically,
yeah. But even if you arrest them and release them, what you're doing is that entire system of control that you're putting over that population enables a handful of soldiers to control a large population. It's through intimidation, through, you know, occasionally beating up a random Palestinian for no reason, and through the arrest process, which they use. They use any kind of tactic to show and establish the strength of their presence in an area. And the military court system is part and parcel of that attitude of establishing strength, possession, and occupation over an area.
I just want to ask, the solitary confinement, the physical abuse, I'm assuming that that's also intended not only to gain a confession, but also to gain information, intelligence information from the child as to who else in the village is causing problems, or... Am I mistaken on that?
Most children do confess against other children as well. So
yeah.
What you end up with, what our lawyers end up with, and what they receive a file for a client, is the confession of that child, the confession of the other children that were with that child, but all of which were all...
The accusation, the confession of the accusation, the finger...
Yeah, like let's say five children went out throwing stones. Mm-hmm. They'll get each of the four to say that the fifth one also threw a stone, and they'll go around. But actually, what we found that there are a few cases where they try to put a lot of pressure on the child to become an ongoing informant. And those cases are more anecdotal. Obviously, it's difficult to get a child to say, yes, I'm now an informant for the Israeli authorities on the record. We know that it does take place, that a lot of that pressure is applied to try and turn some of these children into informants. But the majority of the cases are not that. The majority of the cases are getting children to confess against other children in a very particular incident, but not to become ongoing informants. And then the third thing that our lawyers get is the statement of the arresting military officer. And because it's a military system, they never question the statement of the military officer. So if the military officer will just say, I'm arresting you because I think I saw you throwing stones, that's perfect. You know. And if the child then says, yes, I threw stones, and they get two other children that say, that child threw stones, that's the entirety of the case.
Innocent until suspected.
And then what happens is our lawyers receive this file with these three or four documents, and then they realize you can't really practice law with that amount. You know, they're not allowed to really present evidence or call for evidence. And so what ends up happening is the majority of the cases end up in plea deals between the lawyer and the Israeli military prosecutor. And so it's important for our lawyers, for DCI's lawyers, to maintain good relationships with the military prosecutors in order to get the best deals for these children. And then part of why we say it's a system of control is if a child decides I'm innocent and I don't want to plead guilty for a plea deal, the majority of children are denied bail. About 87% of children are denied bail during their court proceedings. And court proceedings for an offense can take up to a year or longer. And if you're denied bail, you're in prison for that year or longer period. And with a 99% conviction rate, you'd end up essentially spending a year or longer in prison only to get a guilty verdict in the end anyway. Whereas if children do plea deals, we found that most children receive a plea deal between 3 to 12 months, which is actually shorter. It's shorter and a faster way out of the military system if you plead guilty, whether you've done something or not, than if you plead innocent and then get denied bail and spend all that time in jail waiting for a court verdict.
So the average length of stay is between 3 and 12 months.
For children, plea.
Yeah. How much does it cost to incarcerate somebody a child for that period of time, because there's going to be a cost associated with it to Israel. And how many children are locked up for that period?
So the majority, so about like 53% of children that we documented out of the 429 affidavits are the ones that spent between 3 to 12 months. You have the remaining percentages are children who spend under 3 months or children who end up spending well over 12 months. The prison system and how you pay for that stuff is actually very, very interesting. It's actually a bit of an industry where the Israeli system ends up making money out of these children. Out of the canteens that the Israeli system operates within the prison, so let's say you wanted an extra bed sheet, or you wanted toothpaste, or you wanted a toothbrush, or an additional pajama, you'd have to purchase that from the canteen. And I think it's estimated that the canteen makes the Israeli system about 18 million shekels a month.
But how much does it cost to actually incarcerate these kids per month? Because I used to work in jail and prison. That was
fun.
And there's no way we could have ever, even with our mass prison, our mass incarceration us, we could never pay for the costs of incarceration and make money on it through the canteen purchases. And that's not even just because people are poor. Just the costs of the salaries, the infrastructure, the food.
There's no. That's the thing. There's very little infrastructure, very little provided for these, for children specifically here. Yeah. Very little is provided by the Israeli prison service in terms of provisions for these children. So. And I'll compare here with Israeli prisons.
Well, most of those costs would be the salaries anyway.
But there are no salaries. That's the thing. So what they've done is... Wait one sec. Yeah. So what they've done is the Palestinian National Prisoners Committee agreed with the Israeli prison services that several of their adult members would take care of these children and look after these children so that these children don't have direct contact with the Israeli prison guards and therefore wouldn't face abuse by the Israeli prison guards. It's effectively what the National Prisoners Committee ended up doing is they found five Palestinian adult prisoners serving long-term sentences and made them surrogate parents for these children. They live in the same juvenile section as the children, but they're kept in a separate cell.
Did you say these are other people who are criminally convicted?
Who are convicted of so-called security offenses. Security and criminal.
Okay.
So they're not murderers and rapists, they've done security offenses against this.
Which could be something as a false charge or a false confession.
Potentially, some of these are serving the law. They don't want to keep on switching out these five prisoners. Mm-hmm. So the ones that they've selected are ones serving 10 or more years of sentence. So typically their charges tend to be
something real or higher.
Yeah. But basically they're nominated by the National Palestinian Prisoners Committee.
So these guys are overlooking all the kids.
Overseeing the kids. About 70 to 75 kids in Meshuggah prison.
So it's 1 to 75 ratio.
No, it's 5 to 75.
5 to 75, okay. 5 to 75. So who's overlooking those five people?
So then you have a few prison guards, Israeli prison guards, that oversee. So, and then what happens is if the child needs something, he'll tell the surrogate parent, which is that Palestinian prisoner, and then the Palestinian prisoner will tell the head of the National Palestinian Committee based in that prison, who will then have official talks with the warden of that prison.
Ifan, what is the name, please, again, of the prison?
Megiddo, M-E-G-I-D-D-O.
M-E-G-I-D-D-O prison, okay.
So if there were a serious situation with a child, there's not immediate treatment because it's got to go through all of these levels before anyone even...
No, but like if the child was severely sick, for example, then an adult Palestinian prison, one of the adult Palestinians will tell the medical staff immediately and will accompany that child.
Okay, so it doesn't have to go through all those...
No, this is more like the children want, like they have a big demand and it's important. And then,
okay.
And so the way the National Palestinian Prisoners Committee won the right to get these five adults to take care of these children is they went on hunger strike, and it was through long negotiations. And so since 2009, these five individuals have been taking care of these children. And then the prison authorities don't provide the food for the children. In fact, a lot of the food, but I need to double check this, a lot of the food is actually sent in by the Palestinian Authority, and it's sent in uncooked form. So it's, you know, raw chickens and whatever, and it's kept in a freezer. And then the children end up cooking their own meals under the supervision of the five adult prisoners. So the five adult prisoners are actually take care of the children generally, but each has a role, and one of them takes on the role of overseeing, teaching these children how to cook their own meals.
What about health care? Because kids, I mean...
They receive health care, but they're not denied health care. They receive decent health care if something is wrong with them.
Who pays for it? Who pays for it?
Again, no, that would be the Israel Prison Service.
Israel Prison Service does, okay.
So Megiddo would be within Israel. That's Israel.
Megiddo would be within
and
Israel.
That's the Hebrew name for Armageddon, as I recall. Is that, you don't know. I think it is. And the fact that these children are taken out of the occupied territories... And
that's in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And that actually has practical consequences as well, because it means that when their parents go to visit, they need to get a permit, and they need to coordinate with the Red Cross. But a lot of parents struggle to get a permit, and it takes them about two months or longer to get a permit. And sometimes by the time they get that permit, their child is ready to be released anyway. And so they won't visit that child throughout this period of incarceration because of difficulty to get access. Also, things that exist in an Israeli prison for Israeli children that doesn't exist for Palestinian children. Israeli children have access to counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, a lot of educators, and a lot of just general care around them. Also, Israeli children, for example, are taken out on field visits. They get to, sometimes they're released during the holiday periods back to their parents. None of this stuff exists for Palestinian children. Also, Israeli children are taught in keeping with the Israeli curriculum so that upon their release, they could immediately reintegrate back into the school system. A child once took the matriculation exam at an Israeli prison but had a lot of mental health issues. The one thing that kept him calm was having a parrot on his shoulder, so they allowed him to take the exam with a parrot on his shoulder. There's a petting zoo for these. So operating a prison for Israeli children is extremely expensive. Yeah, none of this stuff is provided for Palestinian children. Palestinian children are provided with an education, in quotes, but really the only approved subjects are math, Arabic, and Hebrew. And they're taught at an elementary level, and the way the children are divided is based on their level of assessed intelligence. And so what you end up having is you have an extremely intelligent 17-year-old with an extremely intelligent 13-year-old taking the same math class.
When you put those types of kids together, at that different age range, you're going to have, in the United States anyway, the potential for a lot of bullying, and that creates a whole other series of traumas. Does that go on here, or is there a little bit more empathy among the kids because they're all in a sort of shared experience?
There's a little bit of empathy among the kids, but also there's quite a lot of respect of the five adult prisoners,
and they keep everyone,
in line. And if someone steps out of line, which does actually happen occasionally, they'll, for example, deny them TV privileges.
Right.
They'll find a way to ground that child. Yeah, but in general, we hear of very little actual bullying taking place.
With there being probably a little bullying, you probably also don't hear about sexual assaults on kids or anything.
In
the U.S., in this sort of situation, if the system was set up like this in the U.S., I would guarantee it would happen. I would put my job on it. I don't mean that in a good way. I mean, it would be a really unfortunate consequence.
But no, and again, I think the main difference here is a lot of these is the differentiation between a security offense and a criminal offense.
Yeah.
I think there was a couple of Jerusalem children that were placed that were sort of convicted on a security offense, but placed with other young Israeli offenders. Some of them were like rapists, murderers, and that kid went through quite a lot of abuse.
Yes. In the U.S., the bullying happens in schools. And you're from the U.S., right? Or you're
no, I'm not.
No, but you just did law school in the U.S.
I did journalism school in the U.S.
Oh, journalism school. Okay, so, but yeah, but you know how it is, though. Even in a regular school, the kids experience, you know, the bullying and harassment. So that's great that they don't deal with that. Under this, I mean, that's just.
I mean, there is some.
It's just nice that there's just one less thing that they're subjected to.
That they're subjected to. Yeah.
I was concerned
and
about
it's,
that.
And that's actually a testament to how well, because whenever I tell people that there are five adult male prisoners taking care of these children, people tend to freak out and they're like.
But it seems like they've got to think about the community where they're really supporting.
Yeah, and every child that I've spoken to after having gone through and lived with these five, what they call surrogate parents, they've all had high praise for the five and said they would never survive their prison experience without these five.
That's great.
Are
that's great.
Females ever
arrested?
Yeah.
And female girls under 18, but it's at a far less number than Palestinian boys. So, you know, in February, which was the highest number we recorded ever of Palestinian children in prison, since the Israeli Prison Service started providing that data, we had about 440 children in Israeli custody that month, of which 15 were girls.
And so they're obviously kept someplace else.
Yeah.
And do they have the same surrogate parent situations?
I think because there's so few of them that it hasn't been sort of worked out. Because in the past, up until February of this year, the previous year there was one girl, and she was, I think, 17. And usually with girls, it's a bit of a different situation. Most girls get arrested in the past, not the 15 once this final situation escalated here. But in the past, a lot of girls get arrested because they're actually wanting to get arrested to escape some sort of social issue, so forced early marriage or sexual abuse at home, and they don't know how to escape it. They'll walk up with a knife or something at a checkpoint to get arrested to be taken out of that
situation.
But
they're lucky if they're just arrested.
Well, yeah, they're lucky if they're... And actually, with girls, it's rare that you hear girls getting shot or... The attitude towards boys is far more violent than the attitude towards girls. And this is at least before February of last year. February of last year, no, there were a lot more girls involved and arrested, but a lot more within...
And would those girls also be in prison in Israel?
In Israel, yeah, but in a different prison, in Hasharon,
So there are no prisons in the occupied territories, any prisoners taken?
No, there are prisons in the... So Ofer, where you guys are, where you guys are going, is both a military court and a prison.
Okay.
But technically, once a child is convicted of his crime and is given a final sentence, he's moved out of Ofer. Ofer is only meant to be a temporary holding facility. But because it's easier for children to see their families at Ofer and to attend their court sessions at Ofer, often what they'll do is they'll delay their sentencing until they've spent about 3 months in Ofer, and then they know in their plea deal they're about to get 3 months, and so their transfer inside Israel will only be for that final week, and that ensures they could have access to their parents while at Offer an access to the courts and not have to be transferred between Megiddo and Offer.
And the Israeli military is
sort of goes along with
that.
Yeah, it goes along with it. But now, if a child is going to serve much longer than 3 months, they end up getting shipped to Megiddo. Yeah.
The third educational subject for Palestinian
Arabic, Hebrew, math.
Hebrew.
Yeah.
Hebrew is one of them. And
It's not Hebrew's not offered at all the prisons. So Hebrew's offered at Offer, I believe, but not at Megiddo.
And
none of it, by the way, is in keeping with the Palestinian curriculum. So it's not like So even though you're limited, once you, and actually that's problematic, because even though children are serving like 3 months, and you think, oh, 3 months, it's not the end of the world, the child will get through it somehow, it'll be fine. It won't be fine in the sense that when they fall behind, the Palestinian Ministry of Education has a rule that if an imprisoned child misses more than 60 consecutive days of schooling and they can't keep up with their studies, they would have to repeat the school year.
Right. So it's a double whammy.
Yeah, but it makes sense, because how else can you progress that child forward? The problem is a lot of these children, and something I didn't state at the outset, is come from the most vulnerable families, the most impoverished, people we would be worried about as street kids, but instead here they are contending with the Israeli occupation first. But that means when they're released, their parents can't afford private tutoring or support them to catch up with their classes.
You're basically taking an at-risk kid and making him worse off.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. And also because of that... Because of the experience that children go through, the fact that they're completely cut off from their family throughout their period of the majority of them are cut off for significant periods of their incarceration, it means that the child quickly feels he's become an adult and leaves his childhood behind. And when you want to hold back a child that now feels he's become an adult, he's gone through some sort of rite of passage, they don't want that. They're like, what am I going to be doing with these little kids? You know, I'm now an adult. So a lot of them end up dropping out, getting some sort of vocational training and joining the labor force, where they're open to a lot of exploitation. So, what we realize is those 3 months, 4 months changes the entire trajectory of that kid's life.
You have been listening to a presentation by Ivan Karakashian of the Defense for Children International Palestine. And that wraps it up for this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
I'm able to report that Edison Carter was pulled off the air. The incident has not gone public.
Are we certain the incident was connected with the blip advertisements?
Not yet.
It won't be so simple if news of this leaks out.
My God. Come on, Ben. The only people that inactive are pensioners, the sick, or the unemployed. I mean, who really cares?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Spending our money looking at how the Saudi royal family might be funding extremism. Then, they keep the report secret? With even the survivors and families of the 9/11 victims appealing this week to Theresa May, please publish this report into Saudi funding of extremism in the UK. It's becoming the biggest open secret in the world that the US and the British governments care more about their arms and oil deals with Saudi Arabian dictatorship, that's the royal family to you and me, than they do about keeping us from being blown up or attacked here in Britain. So this week we have a listen to former United Airlines pilot. He was pointing out the massive Saudi connections to the 9/11 attacks 5 years ago in his book, The Big Bamboozle. Before he and his two children were found shot dead in his California home just a few months after the book was published. Well, we hear tonight what no other UK broadcaster, so far as I could find, has seen fit to broadcast. An interview with the killed 9/11 whistleblower Captain Philip Marshall from just before he was forced out in February 2013 when he was found dead. Plus, trouble at Temple Mount in occupied East Jerusalem right now. Our sister show Dialect is on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, the future of the way domestic violence is dealt with in the family courts. Well, we hope so. Local charity Gender Free DV have uncovered worrying evidence of systematic bias in social services and the police. Too quick to apportion blame to men. So why is that? And how do they intend to change things for the better? That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we start this week, Martin, by having a look at this extraordinary appeal that's been made by the families of the victims and some people who were victims themselves of the 9/11 attacks, saying, please release this report, please, Teresa, into Saudi links to extremism. Because as we know, almost all of the hijackers, or alleged hijackers anyway, of the 9/11 planes were Saudis.
Well, I'm glad you said alleged hijackers, because it's not actually clear whether they were on the planes. So let's get them. We need to
and
say
of course,
that.
And of course, Osama bin Laden.
Well, what about him?
Well, he was a Saudi too.
Well, he was, and of course the Saudis are well known. Let's leave 9/11 aside for a minute. The Saudis are well known to be the supporters of Wahhabi, Salafist, Takfiri terrorism all over the world. And they have been since the 1980s. But, of course, they've been working very closely with the Western intelligence services, including CIA, MI6 and Mossad. Mossad and the Saudis work very closely together. So, for example, there was an attempt to try and remove Prince Salman the other week, and the Israelis flew planes to Saudi Arabia to back him up. So, in other words, the idea that the Saudis and the Israelis are on opposite sides is wrong. They're on the same side, and we're on the same side with them.
And now,
and
if you
we support them to arm and train Salafi terrorists.
And if you wanted to read any more about this, that's actually a really good book about it all. It's called Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam, by Mark Curtis. Now, Martin, this does go back quite a while, but we're going to hear now from the House of Commons on Wednesday, where the Green MP Caroline Lucas brought this up, the whole business of the suppression of this report. I mean, you would have thought, wouldn't you, surely, that if our money has been spent on finding out how terrorists might be being funded by the Saudis and other Gulf countries, that maybe we should be told?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, the Prime Minister refused to make public a report on the foreign funding of extremists in the UK, despite pressure from all sides of this House and beyond. With survivors of 9/11 last night also urging her to make this report available, will she explain if her refusal is simply because the contents of the report will embarrass the government's friends in Saudi Arabia, or is it because ministers care rather more about arms sales to Riyadh than they do about public safety in Britain?
It is absolutely nothing to do with that. There is certain confidential information in the report that means that it would not be appropriate to publish it, but my right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, has made it available on a Privy Council basis to opposition parties.
Martin, what do you think that confidential information, national security or whatever it might be, might, you know, what's she talking about? Let's have a guess.
Well, it's basically, the guess is that it's embarrassing for them, because the Saudis are well known to fund extremist mosques in Britain. They do it all over the world. They did it in Pakistan with the support of MI6 and the CIA during Operation Cyclone in the 1980s. And the madrasas that they fund, I mean, basically because they're very wealthy, if you want to build a mosque and you go to the Saudis, they'll give you the money, but then they're going to try and control what you do and what's said in that mosque.
So let's have a listen this week to the former United Airlines pilot who was pointing out these massive Saudi connections to the 9/11 attacks 5 years ago in his book, The Big Bamboozle.
Our guest is Captain Philip Marshall. Your book is so well written, it's very articulate, and it's clever, and it's scary as hell. It's one of those works you just want to linger over, because not only is it well written, but you can't believe what you're reading.
Yeah, it's really hard to believe some of this stuff. I wanted to talk about where I got this title from. It's a Carl Sagan quote that I really love. He said, "One of the saddest lessons in history is this. If we've been bamboozled long enough, we tend to reject any evidence of the bamboozle." The whole episode of 9/11 is just getting out of control. As I explained in the book, I was studying the Bush administration for probably 10 years prior to 9/11. I was knee-deep in the BCCI scandal. I was looking into the SNL loan. I was part of the Iran-Contra affair. I didn't know it at the time. I was in the Special Activities Division, which is a real gray area for people. I think most of the people that are doing special activities for these illegal operations aren't aware that they're actually in special activities. I was knee-deep into it. I was really getting nervous when I saw that W was running for president, and then to see the way he won the election with his brother counting the deciding votes, I knew that we were in big trouble. So it didn't really surprise me. By the time I saw the third replay, I smelled a rat. The good news for anything that's done in an airliner is that it's recorded. Everything is recorded. Every sentence, every word you say in the cockpit is recorded. Every move you make with the yoke is recorded. Every transmission is recorded. I knew that at some point we would get to the bottom of this. By the time they released the NTSB reports and the black box data and all that, they'd already given us this bamboozle that it was some ghost that lived in a cave on the other side of the world that had defeated our entire U.S. national security. So I started writing it back in 2005. I really started studying it then when I had all the information, and I put it together. Maybe it would have been, you know, who they said it was. But when I looked into the NTSB, when I saw the flight patterns and everything, it was very obvious to me that these guys had been trained very well. Some of them weren't even pilots when they came to the U.S. And when I found the Congressional Inquiry Report that was headed by Senator Bob Graham, very, very interesting. As soon as I saw that report, I knew that we had found where they were trained. And when the hijackers came into Los Angeles on January the 15th of 2000 on a Thai Airways flight from Bangkok, their movements for 18 months were chronicled by FBI agents, field agents. We could see that Saudi spies, as Senator Graham called them, were aiding these guys. They were giving them logistical support. They were giving them financial support, opening bank accounts. They followed these guys all the way until December of 2000. 80 pages worth in the Congressional Inquiry Report chronicles this. And around December of 2000 is when they went into a go mode. And the go mode was they all went out to the Arizona desert. There's a lot of documentation on that. They had FBI agents sending up warnings. Hey, we've got a bunch of Saudi guys out here learning how to fly airplanes, and I think they're trying to pull some kind of a terrorist operation. Those warnings were ignored, and we can see that there was three of the pilot hijackers. My focus was on the pilots.
Where did you happen to be on September 11, 01?
I just finished a four-day trip. I was flying up and down the West Coast for 4 days and got home around midnight on September the 10th. So I was exhausted. I was tired. My phone started ringing at 6 o'clock in the morning. I was thinking, I'll just sleep through this one. But it just kept ringing and ringing. And then I went and checked the messages, and I got all these crazy things. Are you watching this? What in the world is this? Are you okay? I hope you're not flying New York. And I had no idea what was going on. I turned the television set on, and I saw the building on fire. The North Tower was on fire, and I couldn't believe it. It's like windows were blown out of all sides of it, black smoke coming out. And I'm thinking, what does this have to do with me? And then I saw the United 767 strafing Manhattan. It was like a wild thought. Like, what in the world? One of our pilots, is he trying to get a better view of this or what? And when he banked into that building, I just about jumped out of my skin. I could not believe it. How could this be? How could a United Airlines captain fly purposely into a building like that? And every time I watch that replay, I still jump at it. It just is so unnatural to see a suicidal attack with such a beautiful airplane. It was sad, and I started thinking about all my fellow pilots and had no idea who was in that airplane. And later on, I found out, and it's really sad. It hit our airline so hard. It hit us as employees so hard. It was very hard to see, and it hasn't gotten any better. But
no.
I vowed that day that I was going to find out who was behind this. And I can tell you that I am absolutely 100% sure I know who was behind it now.
When I put together the tactical plan on this attack, there's so much evidence of aviation experts, and they knew exactly which airplanes to hijack, ones that were full of fuel going from East Coast to the West Coast. But when I put it together and saw when the airplanes pushed back from the gates, and they all pushed back on time, and they picked the perfect day, it was a beautiful weather day, there were no weather delays at all. The routes were very predictable, but the attack was designed to be done. From the time they pushed back, an hour later, those attacks needed to be done. And when you see the two planes that hit the World Trade Center, those ones were executed to perfection. They hit it just right. There was no way that there could have been a military intervention unless there just happened to be some fighters flying over the area. Where this thing really, where they get caught with their pants down is the two that were delayed. Like United 93 encountered some delays on the ground at Newark before it took off. They crossed, they were 112 miles to the north of Washington at the perfect time. And for some reason, they continued on. Whether there was confusion with the hijackers or some sort of a malfunction, I don't know why they didn't take the airplane from that point and just drive it right to D.C. Because when we look at the black box recordings, when we see the navigational frequencies that were set in, they were set in to Washington National Airport. So that tells us that that's where that airplane was intending to go. By the time they took over the airplane, they were 300 miles to the west. And that created a delay. And it seemed that everything was set up for it to be done around 9:10 at the latest. And that airplane didn't hit until 9:40. So there was 30 minutes is an eternity in aviation when you're moving at 500 miles an hour. I think they were busted, basically, but no one read it. No one analyzed it. If they would have turned in right then, and American 11 that came out of Dulles, he too went 300 miles to the west. And when the cockpit was being taken over, that was about the same time that United 175 hit the South Tower. So there was plenty of time for scrambles out of Andrews and out of Langley that should have intercepted those airplanes. So when you see the president reading the pet goat, I think what he was doing is waiting for the attack to be completed. If they would have done it on time, he could have jumped up at 9:05 and started scrambling everything. It would have really looked like they were trying to stop it.
Is it your opinion Flight 93 was headed for the Capitol Dome?
I don't know if it was headed for the Capitol Dome. That's my guess. I do know that it was from the black box recordings where we can see where the navigational frequencies were manually entered into the navigation. We know that they were set into the localizer frequency at Washington National Airport. So we know that's where they were planned to go. What happened with that flight was that that's where they should have taken it over when it was 112 miles to the north. When they ended up taking over the airplane, they were out of range for that frequency, for that localizer at National. And basically that pilot got lost out there. He didn't have anything to navigate with. He didn't have anything to hook the autopilot up with. So you can see that how he made a couple other mistakes with the autopilot. He actually got up to about 40,000 feet, which is way too high at that weight. You can get up to 40,000 in a 757, but you have to burn a lot of fuel off before you can do that. And he almost stalled the airplane out 250 miles from the target, and he ended up crashing at 112 miles from downtown Washington. There's a lot of indications that people knew that this attack was coming. I remember watching the news that day, and there was media reports saying that the Capitol was the target. I don't know how in the world anyone would know that for sure. There's a lot of signs that people knew that it was coming, and there was a lot of back-channel stuff going on that was promoting this evildoer, this Osama bin Laden was getting ready to strike and all this. I think those were rumors. I think those were back-channel. It was a setup for the bamboozle, basically. They had all these reports, supposedly, that went up to the White House, and those reports kept saying that, oh, this guy bin Laden's getting ready to strike. And as an airline captain at that time, no one told me there was a threat out there. No one told anybody else that these threats were out there. So I thought it was really interesting. And when I looked into the evidence on bin Laden, you know, through the congressional inquiry who looked into it for a long time, almost a year, there's no operational evidence at all on bin Laden. They have 80 pages worth on the Saudi intelligence.
On the cover of your book is the seal of the intelligence community. Why is that seal there?
the intelligence community. You hear it a lot on the media, but you really don't know what it is. And I started picking up that whoever this intelligence community was, they were the ones in the reports that kept saying, oh, the intelligence community says that bin Laden is behind 9/11 because, and then there was nothing after the because, really, except for that he wrote a fatwa back in 1998. So that's the only evidence that's cited anywhere, is that he wrote a fatwa that he was going to strike the United States. So I started looking in, okay, so who is the intelligence community? We present this evidence of who the intelligence community is. They're every armed authority of the United States as a result of 9/11, as a result of the attack. They control the Department of Homeland Security, the TSA, the CIA, the FBI, the energy, and the big one is the United States Treasury. They have learned how to go around our Congress and tap directly into the Treasury. And those are our tax dollars that are sitting there as the grand prize for anyone that has taken over the United States government, is that they get to the Treasury, and they control the Treasury. From now on, anyone who reads this book will know the rest of their life when they hear in the intelligence community what exactly that is. And it's being run from a 1.4 million square foot building called the George Bush Center of Intelligence right outside of Washington. So the way I see it is that they have overpowered our government. They have overpowered the three branches of equal power with scare tactics. We got to throw all of our money at terrorism. So $15 trillion has disappeared since the time that George W. Bush took over. They spent every penny that we've sent them in our taxes, and then $15 trillion on top of that. So I'm wondering, where did all that money go, and who's controlling that money? It's a pattern that I was studying before that. The BCCI scandal was very fishy type. They got into the Treasury, and billions of dollars disappear almost on a daily basis for the last 10 years.
So how did these guys do this, and where did they receive their training, and who arranged that?
That was the first thing that really raised the red flag for me, was when I got the NTSB reports and saw the flight patterns and the black box recordings and all that are very, very accurate, and they all lined up to the half second with everything. So I put that together. I've got all the black box recordings so people can see. They can go in there and look at it. When airline pilots look at this thing, they go, holy smoke, how in the world did they know how to do that? So it's very obvious to me that they had a Boeing instructor and Boeing airplane. There was no doubt about that. For instance, I tried to fly the pattern of American 77, the one that hit the Pentagon, and I flew it 300 miles to the west is where this Hani Hanjour, who was the pilot, he was a Saudi guy from the same hometown as the Prince Bandar, who was documented as funding this operation through the Riggs Bank. He took the airplane from 300 miles west, made the perfect turnaround. Of course, that was a pretty easy one there because he was going west. So all he had to do is reverse course for his navigation. So then he came back into Washington. He came over Dulles Airport around 9,000 feet. He clicked the autopilot off at 7,000 feet, and you can see he kind of waved it a little bit. I mean, I can't imagine flying that airplane single pilot. You know, I rely on my co-pilot. You know, you're basically a two-headed, four-armed monster in the cockpit of one of those airliners, and you're checking and cross-checking, and we have all types of procedures that we're watching each other. Almost doesn't cut it in the airline business. You know, oh, I almost got to 7,000 feet. I leveled off at 6,000. Yeah, well, that's great, but you just killed 500 people. It doesn't cut it. But at any rate, he clicked off the autopilot at 7,000 feet, and coming right at the Pentagon. He, too, had National Airport locked in on his navigation. So on a beautiful day like that, he could pick up the target visually. And when he did that, he came over the Pentagon. He was way high. He was at 7,000 feet. And the Pentagon's not that easy to spot, really, from the air. It's kind of a spread out building, and there's a lot of other buildings in the area. You really have to know what you're looking for. Now, he came down 7,000 feet, and he did a steep descending turn and rolled out at 2,500 feet with the Pentagon in the windshield in front of him. Now, think about what was going on at that time. They just killed two pilots. It was a murder scene. It was chaos. It was, I can't can't even imagine trying to stay focused in a situation like that. But this guy had the situational awareness to roll out at 2,500 feet and started diving towards the Pentagon. And then he pushed the throttles up to the firewall. Now, when I tried that in the simulator, you know, I'm a pretty big guy. I'm 220 pounds, 6'3", 220, something like that. I could not hold the yoke down because those engines produce something like 60,000 pounds of thrust each. So that thing's climbing like a bat out of hell. I actually missed it on the first. I was 1,000 feet and climbing when I went over it the first time in the sim. It took me 4 tries to hit the building. And the only way I could do that was to start trimming the nose down before I pushed the throttles up. So according to the official intelligence community, this was this guy's first time in the cockpit of a 757. I don't think so. So that leads me to believe that, hey, somebody trained them. Can I find any evidence that someone trained them? Well, when I found the Congressional Joint Inquiry Report and learned that as soon as these guys hit the ground in Los Angeles on January 15th, they were met by employees of the Saudi Aviation Authority. And they were connected to a company called Dala Avco, which is a Saudi operator, kind of a contractor for the Saudi government that operates Boeing airplanes. So that tells me right there, it's like, oh, there it is. I found where they got instructors from, and I found out where they got the manuals from and the expertise that was needed to fly this particular mission. My next step was, okay, now I need to find an airport and I need to find airplanes. And the FBI guys were following these guys out into this triangle out in Arizona. And I started looking around out there. They have these storage airports. The banks own most of the airplanes that are leased by the airlines. And sometimes in between these leases, they're parked at these storage airports. And one airport really started to stick out. It had 757s and 767s parked on the field in the summer of 2001. And it was a CIA airport from back in the Air America days. So that started to raise some red flags. And then on top of that, there was number three guy at the CIA who was appointed by W in June of 2001. His firm was the one that was placing all these trades on the airlines that went down. He had put options on 2 airlines, or he didn't, but his firm did. Jeremy Scahill is a investigative author that wrote extensively about Pinal Air Base out there. And that's where these guys disappeared to. That's where they were. That's where the FBI reported seeing them out in the Arizona desert. And at the same time, the head of the Saudi intelligence, the longtime guy, Prince Turki Al-Fazl, was in the area. He was up in Las Vegas. He was in the same desert. About 100 guys that disappeared, or they flew out about a week after the attack.
Quoting from the Big Bamboozle, a silent, confounding shift went unnoticed by most American voters. While Ronald Reagan gave great speeches with positive messages accented with humor and perhaps the best timing of any politician in U.S. history, Bush and Baker slipped into the White House basement to build a covert government with CIA, DEA, and black ops assets. Today, this operation is called the Intelligence Community.
I have some connections that remain in the spook world. There's a lot of contractors out there. Blackwater is one of them. It's a pretty tight circle. Aviation's a pretty tight circle in itself. But this particular strain of pilot, we keep in touch, let's just put it that way. And I started getting hints of this Pinal Air Base from about 3 guys that work in that field. I have to be very careful about that because they still provide information to me. When I started hearing about what was going on, I actually took a little trip out there to just north of Tucson in a little town called Marana, Arizona. You can see it on Google Earth. Even then, it's very, very hard to spot. But there's this airport out in the middle of nowhere. It's a triangular airport that has 3 runways on it. And there's about 100 airliners there in storage right now. They're cannibalized if they're there for a while in the lucrative parts market. You know, but they're still airworthy airplanes that are ready to go. They're just in between leases. So I took a little trip out there. And I can tell you they've got some big rattlesnakes on the south end of that airport. At any rate, I did a little investigating of my own out there, and I looked around. One day I went out there, and I saw that there was 5 747s. This is a county-owned airport, and they wouldn't let me on the airport. They had a Evergreen International is one of the famous spook contractors, but they wouldn't let me pass the guard gate. I just act like I was an aviation enthusiast, just wanted to take pictures or whatever. So I talked to a couple of people around the airport that live around the airport, and they were telling me that many times people are trying to take pictures of that airport, and they'll send a car out there and confiscate the camera and all kinds of bad activities like that. But when I was out there, this was in about 06, 07. There was 747s, cargo, that were being loaded up, and I have no idea where they were going. There was all types of Black Hawk helicopters flying around. It looked like LaGuardia Airport. There was so much traffic out there in the middle of the desert. The 757s and 767s were parked there. We have pictures of them. That's on our Facebook. We have a bunch of videos on Facebook that I think are really good. The Big Bamboozles, the page on that. And there's quite a good history. If you go online, you can see, if you Google it, you can see, look up the Pinal, P-I-N-A-L, Air Park. It's well known as a long-time CIA-operated airport. There's a lot of controversy about trying to shut it down years ago. People that are on the board of directors are CIA people. So it has a long connection all the way back to, like I said, Air America.
Why was this done? Who financed it? And who's the king rat who orchestrated all of this? I never thought it was a very good idea to have the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency become president. So you think Bush and Cheney were involved in this?
When we put the timing on the attack together and we see who knew what and when they knew it, the FAA knew about 35 minutes before the airplane hit the North Tower. American 11 came out of Boston. The FAA was following these guys. All of a sudden, the transponder went off, and this thing makes a beeline towards Manhattan. So there was teleconferences going on between Boston and New York, FAA headquarters. They were well aware that this airplane had been hijacked. And on top of that, Muhammad Atta, who was flying American 11, thought he was talking to the passengers at one point, and he was actually talking to ATC, which is air traffic control, and everything's recorded. He basically said, everybody, don't make any stupid moves and things like that. The controllers that were working that flight knew right away that this thing was a hijack, and they started calling people left and right. When I put the times together, when all these calls were made, Condoleezza Rice, who Steve Pasesnik, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a real interesting insider with the State Department. He said it was a false flag operation, that Condoleezza Rice was part of it. So I do concur with that, because when she had a telephone conversation with Bush at 8:55, after the American 11 had hit the North Tower, and in that conversation, she was talking to him and said, all we know is that it was a twin-engine airplane that crashed into the North Tower. The only way she would have known that, and technically that's true, but if you say, oh, it's a twin-engine airplane, you're thinking a smaller, lighter plane type thing. 767 is a twin-engine airplane, but it weighs 300,000 pounds. For her to know that it was a twin-engine airplane, the only way she would have known that was because the FAA told her that, unless she had a eyewitness that just happened to be in downtown Manhattan and say, oh, you look like a twin-engine airplane to me. It makes no sense. Finally, they got her to testify in 2004. Of course, the media had already convicted the ghost. But at any rate, if you think about it, the only way she would have known it was a twin-engine airplane was from the FAA. And the only reason they were talking about that airplane was because they knew it was a hijack. So again, there's a just pants down type thing. There's no way she could have known that. And that's before he went into the classroom. He sat there until 9:02, fidgeting, looking around, and looked like a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. And then when the second one hit, what he needed to hear was that the attack was complete, and all he heard was that the two had hit. So he had to stall. He had to wait. They must have been nervous. Whoever was behind this must have been sweating bullets at this point, because two of them had hit and two of them were missing at that point, and probably they didn't know where the other two were. So that, to me, tells me that there's something stinky about it. And before, too, with the 23 supposed PDBs that were sent up to the president, and he didn't take any action. He didn't alert airline pilots. He didn't alert anyone. It just stinks. And I think there was one reporter that asked him, hey, were you behind this? No one's ever asked him that directly, except for that time. and he just looked like a deer caught in the headlights when they asked him that question. It's online. I've seen it a few times. But it's almost funny the way he didn't know what to say.
Who financed this? What are the indications?
Well, again, the Congressional Joint Inquiry followed the financing that went to the hijackers. There was a Riggs Bank account in Washington, D.C. that Prince Bandar bin Sultan, you know, the good friend of, they call him Bandar Bush, he's so tight with the Bush family, he opened an account, and his wife had an account, and the Congressional Inquiry said there was unlimited funding from Saudi Arabia. The guy that met him in Los Angeles a couple of days after the hijackers arrived had seemingly unlimited financing from Saudi Arabia. That's a quote from their report. Unlimited. Seemingly unlimited financing from Saudi Arabia.
What's in it for the Saudis?
There's definitely a thread in all of this stuff that makes its way to Saudi Arabia. And before 9/11, I was studying this relationship between the Bush family and the Saudi government. They were definitely involved in the BCCI scandal. They were definitely involved in the other covert operation from the Reagan-Bush administration, which was the Iran-Contra financing. So there's an alliance there somewhere. It's power. It's definitely something to do with a lot of power. If you've got control of the oil markets, and absolute power is what they have over there, and absolute power is what the intelligence community is working on right now. And they're trying to outpower our congressional, our judicial branch, and the executive branch. President Obama has stated many times that he wants to prosecute this Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that's down there in Guantanamo. And right next to him was the attorney general. So there you have two of the three branches right there that want to prosecute him. But for some reason, and they announced that they were going to have the trial in New York a couple of years ago. And I've been watching it really close, and I still can't tell you how that got derailed. But it's an absolute power type thing.
Closing Guantanamo Bay and dragging all those people into civilian court, they might sing about who's actually behind this.
Absolutely. You're a pilot. You understand situational awareness. You have to realize how you got into a situation to figure your way out of it. If we use the judicial system like Obama promised in his campaign in 2008, because I realized in 2005 that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had nothing. He has no aviation expertise. You're trying to tell us that this guy is the one that found holes in the U.S. military air defenses? That would really be embarrassing to some of these Air Force generals that have gone to military school all these years, that this guy figured out, oh, this is how we can penetrate the U.S. air defense. It's impossible. It's a big bamboozle. So if this guy came to trial, the lid would be blown off of this thing, and it would change Washington. And I think that if you brought this guy, you would see a lot of corporate jets flying nonstop to Argentina.
How were these pilots able to have so much time without running into some fighters?
If the attack would have been executed the way I believe it was drawn up, where these guys would take off in the first 15 minutes, got to altitude, and then just shot right to their targets, it was a good tactical plan. Two of them hit on plan. The other two delayed for almost another hour. It's very interesting that there was a competent response from the military at first. They launched two F-15s out of Otis Air Force Base out in Cape Cod, but they wouldn't have made it there. They didn't make it in time. So I think it's really suspicious that when the attack started to encounter delays, that all of a sudden there was a, seems like a military stand down until it got completed. And when we go back and look at what Dick Cheney was running the response from the White House, it becomes very apparent. There was a meet the press on that next Sunday, and he said that they launched more fighters and that they ordered a shoot down. But when we checked that, and more specifically when Jeremy Scahill checked that, and Philip Sheehan, who wrote the commission, there were seven logs taken on those conversations between Cheney and Bush, and none of them mentioned a shoot down order or even a scramble. So I thought this guy, Steve Posednik, that came out after the bin Laden, that crazy raid that they supposedly killed him. He came out and said that he used to teach that at military school, that stand down. So it seems to me there was a very obvious stand down. And then as soon as they got the word that United 93 crashed, and that was the fourth one, then they launched some fighters. But when they got over there, only smoke was in the sky at that point. Everything else was done. So it's a really very suspicious that for that hour, we couldn't get one fighter airborne.
Do you sense that there is an encroaching police state and that this is just one in a series of false flag attacks that are designed to bring about a totalitarian regime, at least in contrast to what we've grown up with or what we thought we had?
I have my opinions about that, but to tell you the truth, I am not an expert in that area. My message really is that this was a Saudi operation that was probably covered by our special activities division. But when you put it together and you see who is given this fable about bin Laden and all that, those are the same people who are developing the DHS and the TSA. Supposedly some guy in a cave attacked us, but grandma going through security at Des Moines Airport is getting shaken down. And it's troubling to see this systematic takeover of the government. And I don't know what the big picture is. I don't know what they saw down the road that may have been a bigger number, that may have been leading to something bigger that they stopped. I don't know why this attack led us to go invade Iraq, other than it was written in a, I don't know if you're familiar with the Project for a New American Century, but that's one of my pieces of evidence that's on our evidence sources. That plan that they came up with, it was a theoretical attack. They called it a new Pearl Harbor, and that would help America get into a war mentality. And it just seems that that plan, if you look at it now, 11 years later, is the same thing that's happened. It's actually transpired exactly like that. They talk about using Predator drones and Blackwater-type mercenary armies. And it's so encompassing now because what it's done is given this great authority, this fear of an enemy that I don't really think is there. And it's given them a lot of power. There's a lot of hysteria involved when you go to the airport now. You know, they're telling you, look at your neighbor, look around, see who looks suspicious. We got everybody looking at each other, and now they're looking into our lives. And everything's being coordinated with DHS and the DMV now out here. It's very suspicious that it's the very same people that are telling us that it was a terrorist attack. They're the same people that are clamping down, and their power has gone up so much.
Now, that's Philip Marshall there. He's Captain Philip Marshall, author of The Big Bamboozle. The book came out in September 2012. And Philip was sadly found dead, shot in the head, with his two sons also shot. Officially, the police say, Martin, that it was a murder-suicide. He'd killed his two children and then shot himself, although the gun was found underneath his body.
Well, if you believe that, I've got a suspension bridge to sell you. Is all I can say.
So that was just 3 months later, after the publication of The Big Bamboozle. And this interview you just heard there was on the US show Coast to Coast in between times, obviously.
Yeah, does that sound like somebody who's about to murder themselves and their two children?
Certainly doesn't to me. It could also be that he's talking quite a lot there about his contacts within the black ops community. So there is this, you know, airline, these aircraft involved in all sorts of black ops. He mentions there Iran-Contra too. In fact, he even implies that he was involved as a pilot in Iran-Contra but didn't realise what was going on. I mean, is it possible, do you think, that someone could be flying from A to B and just simply not know what's in the back of the plane?
Well, if you were running these kind of you wouldn't want everybody to know every aspect of what's going on. It's all on a need-to-know basis, for surely. I mean, that's how you'd run it.
So what do you make of some of what he was saying there about these Saudi connections? I mean, he's actually joined a hell of a lot of dots there together, even saying that that there was this whole thing of unlimited funds by the Saudis.
Well, I think the idea that the Saudis had a hand in it is perfectly clear. And the Saudis, of course, are intimately linked with the Western intelligence services. The BCCI scandal was the CIA's bank. The BCCI was their bank, and they used it to fund Saudi funds to the Mujahideen fighting in Afghanistan, who were trained by British and American special forces. I mean, we know all of this. We know that we set up al-Qaeda. Nobody disputes this. But what we're then told is we lost control of it. We set it all up. We trained them all. We gave them loads of money. And then these ungrateful Muslims turned on us, even though we were their allies. And I think what he's done is he's exposed a lot of contradictions in the official story. But I have to say, I don't think any of those pilots were flying those planes. The planes were flown probably to my mind, from the ground by Global Hawk technology.
Well, you're talking about the same planes that took off from Boston Airport?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite in the 1970s, the US had already developed so-called Global Hawk technology, where they flew a...
The passengers that got on those planes?
Those passengers are either dead, because they're just roadkill, or there's a suggestion that the one that was shot down or went down at Shankill, that in actual fact the passengers weren't really on the plane. Now, I think there are different levels.
What about, hang on, the relatives of those who died would take issue with you?
Yeah, well, I mean, don't forget in 1964, the Northwoods plan was that there would be planes supposedly bombed by Cuba, and then there would be loads of funerals, but the people wouldn't actually be dead, they'd just be pretending to be dead, and they'd even have relatives crying and saying, my relatives are dead. Now, I don't know what exactly happened, but I'm just saying in 1964, the plan wasn't just to kill the passengers. In actual fact, the Iranians uncovered that virtually everybody on the Shankill plane, was working for the US military. Every single one. Now, it might be an accident that everybody on a civilian airliner happens to work for the US military, but it then raises a question, well, perhaps not. I think the actual detail of how the attack was carried out is secondary.
In his book, Philip goes deeply into the raid, which supposedly killed bin Laden, and he says that the evidence that's been produced is absolutely nothing, that this raid even took place, really. The photographs show this, so we can't show you the photographs because they're too gruesome. And he said, well, hang on a minute, because you were doing, apparently, for months beforehand, a surveillance operation on this, where you kept telling us that bin Laden would walk out backwards and forwards, and he would be pacing backwards and forwards every day. I mean, surely you could show us one of those photographs, and that's not going to be a gruesome photograph to look at.
Well, Seymour Hersh, the investigative journalist, has already questioned this. And he's the one, of course, that's questioned the sarin attacks in Syria and exposed the My Lai massacre.
And what do you make of his assertion there, that the thing that needs to happen with the 9/11 attacks is that they need to go to court? People who have been accused of it need to go into US courts. Instead, there's still some of them languishing in Guantanamo.
Yeah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was eventually put on trial after 183 waterboarding sessions, and he supposedly confessed his role in the attack. Now, in actual fact, I think he's barking very much up the right tree here. It's quite clear that the Saudi intelligence services, working with the Western intelligence service and with Mossad, are the most likely culprits. And I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Okay, well, you say there's no doubt about it. What's your evidence?
Well, the evidence, I suggest, is everybody can see that the 19 hijackers were supposedly Saudis. Although what happened, the Daily Telegraph and the BBC reported the week after that various people who were supposedly the hijackers actually put their hands up and said, hang on a minute, I am that person and I'm not dead and I wasn't flying the plane. Now, that was reported by the BBC and the Telegraph and then forgotten about. It's not believable to me that hijackers got on these planes and took over the planes with box cutters and then flew them to the targets. He's also missed the point that they didn't fly directly to the targets. They flew around all over the place in airspace that's supposedly defended by the most advanced air force in the world, the United States Army Air Force. None of these planes supposedly were even intercepted. Now, what happens when the Russians fly a bomber towards Scotland? It's intercepted within 10 or 15 minutes. These planes fly around inside the most heavily defended airspace in the world. The Pentagon has supposedly got missiles in it that shoot anything down that tries to overfly it. I don't believe that plane was flown by Hani Hanjour and turned and crashed into the building. That all of the planes were flown by Global Hawk technology. But that's, in a sense, only a quibble. Because he's got the essence of the story, which is this just is not a believable story. It wasn't believable on the day. It's even less believable all these years later with all the evidence that's gradually been gathered. And, of course, the unpleasant truth is that the Saudi intelligence services and the Western intelligence services and the Israeli intelligence services are false flag terrorists. Always have been.
What do you make of his quote right at the start there from Carl Sagan saying that people just simply do not want to admit it, that they've been bamboozled? The longer a bamboozle goes
right.
on.
That's right. The real problem is not that people are bamboozled, it's that they don't like to admit that they've been bamboozled. So this is the people who plot these things are very well aware of how they can control perception of the people on the receiving end, i.e. us. And Penn and Teller would understand what we're talking about. The great Randy would understand what we're talking about. The great Houdini would understand what we're talking about. People's minds and perceptions can be controlled by those who have sufficient technique. And that's the purpose of it all. They're not just destroying things for the sake of it. You've got to ask the question, qui bono, who benefits? And the benefit was quite clear. The Israelis and the Western powers use this as an excuse to invade Afghanistan, Iraq, etc.
Very, very little
places
in the British,
where they wanted to go in
very,
the first
place. Very, very little in the British press about this. Certainly this interview wasn't broadcast in Britain at all. There was no interview about the Big Bamboos or a review of his book in the British press. Why do you think that is?
Because the press are controlled by press barons and the government. It's, you know, we've got an independent radio show here on community radio, and we can investigate relatively fearlessly with our very limited resources. But if you want a job on the Daily Mail or the BBC, it's career suicide to ask questions like this. Career suicide. Although some people, like Simon Hirsch, have started to ask questions about things like the so-called sarin attacks in Syria and so on. I mean, people just need... People can't... Following the detail, even for trained journalists and intelligence agents, with all the time in the world and a proper salary, you can't keep up with it all.
Well,
so the ordinary
exactly,
punters, I mean, who are spending most of their time watching Strictly Come Dancing and the football, are definitely not going to be able
to
keep up with
exactly
it.
Well, so this is pretty much what Philip says there. He says he's spoken to lots of journalists who simply say, look, we just can't go there. As an organisation, we can't publish this stuff.
Well, that's obviously the case. And that's because the control of perception is what this is all about. If you did this and you couldn't control the perceptions afterwards, it would be a waste of time. So that's why they do this. But they also want to control the perception of what's happened. So, for example, our contributor there, our dead contributor, has basically taken at face value the statements of the US government about the timeline and the events.
Now, well, National Transportation Safety Board.
Well,
yeah.
Yes, well, exactly. But the fact is, none of the hijackers appear on the passenger manifests of any of the planes. So
may be using false passports.
Well, they may be using false passports. I'd like to know what names they were using. That's what the FBI finally found.
I mean, there are
that's
other
what
things
the FBI
to do.
Finally said. They said, "Oh, actually, we know that these people did it, but none of them used their own passports."
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a passport in the
ruins of the World Trade Center.
It's a bit of a quibble.
Unbelievable.
It's a bit of a quibble, and also it's quite feasible that because if you have a look at the traces, there are gaps in the transponder response. That is this little device on the plane that tells all the air traffic control people where it is. There are gaps, so it's feasible that at one plane was flying along and then actually another remote control plane took over it and the first plane then just landed somewhere else.
Well, that's what is suspected. That's what the plan was in Operation Northwoods in 1964, is that the plane with the passengers on would land and then another plane with nobody on would then crash into something or get blown up, and the passengers wouldn't really be killed, but they would then pretend to be killed and there'd be funerals and so on. Now, if I was going to do something like that, I'd just kill the passengers. But the detail of how it was done is still obscure. But the basic pattern is clear. This is a false flag attack, like many others that we've seen.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
Also, a few other stories this week, Martin. The Turks are publishing US troop locations in Syria, and the United States are furious.
Well, the locations which they've published are where the US forces are coordinating with the YPG Kurdish forces, which, of course, are at war in Turkey. PKK is at war with the Turkish state. So this is the Turks, basically getting their own back on the Americans, partly for the attempted coup to remove Erdogan.
We've also heard today, just now, Sean Spicer has resigned as Trump's press secretary. He doesn't like the way the various staff that Trump's been picking.
So he's resigned rather than being sacked.
That's what it says. Often that means he's been sacked, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, I suppose it does. I mean, the fact is it's a shambles, isn't it? And, of course, the shambolic US administration is being bullied along by the deep state forces we've just been analysed to do the things they want to do. I don't think Trump's directly involved in all of this, which is why they were worried about him taking over. But basically, he is a puppet by any other name. And he's not a puppet of the Russians.
Israeli general says, we won't let Iran win the Syria war.
well, they've been supporting the rebels inside Syria all the way, including the Al-Qaeda rebels. You know, the Al-Qaeda that carried out the 9/11 attack? The Israelis have been helping them to fight the Syrian army? Oh, but the British have been helping them to fight the Syrian army as well, and so have the Americans. Al-Qaeda in Syria has been armed and trained by exactly the same forces that carried out the 9/11 attack. And this is what's, you know, this is what happened. And of course, we are told that after 9/11, we suddenly realised we shouldn't have been arming and training these terrorists. And then in Syria, there we are doing exactly the same thing again. I think it points to the finger where, who's really responsible.
Okay,
for
finally,
this.
Emmanuel Macron, the new French president, says anti-Zionism is a new type of anti-Semitism.
Well, he's just basically another puppet, isn't it? What we said earlier, the Israeli
so
state.
Would you rather Marine Le Pen had won?
No. I would have voted for Macron to keep Le Pen out, but I wouldn't have voted for Le Pen in the first place. I would have voted for Mélenchon.
So why is he saying this? Is anti-Zionism actually really?
No, it's not. As we said in the first hour, the state of Israel was recognised in 1948 on the understanding that it would remain in certain boundaries, including none of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was not in the state as given to Israel in 1948. And they may say, but it's ours. No, it isn't. It wasn't given to you. You have just taken it.
So what would
as Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, you had no right to be in Kuwait, you've got no right to be
in Jerusalem.
What would
you do as a young Muslim wanting to worship at Al-Aqsa in Friday prayers today?
Well, what can you do? If you can't go through, they're not going to let you through. You can't go through, can you? What I might do is join an organisation that was going to enter into an armed struggle against the Israeli state, which I would have every right to do under international law. It's absolutely clear in international law, Israeli occupation can be resisted militarily. The population have got a right under international law to kill Israeli soldiers.
Martin, it doesn't sound like you want peace in Jerusalem.
I'm not a pacifist, Tony. If we're going to have World War III, let's have it and make sure the bad guys lose. That's what happened the last two times.
It sounds like you're saying the sooner the better.
Well, I'm afraid it's too late now to back down. We're going to World War III's already started if you live in Syria. They've taken hundreds of thousands of casualties. It's not over yet, but the good guys are winning and we're not the good guys. The British military personnel in Saudi Arabia, several hundred of them, I'm sure they're all going to come home for a pension at our expense, but if a patriot was to manage to blow their brains out, they would be in the right, and the British soldiers who are there would be in the wrong. I'm not a pacifist. Let's fight.
Well, I am. I think we should have peace instead. So Tony. I don't think we'll agree
peace
on that.
Peace is not always possible.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Green Party councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas, former Bradley Stoke councillor, now UKIP leadership candidate, that's Ben Walker. Also thanks to Old Labour at Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is onewordthisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with some music from 1975. That's Diana Ross. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalid Bendib. This week, we continue our conversation with Adel Iskandar, Professor of Global Communications at Simon Fraser University, about the rise, history, and future of the Al Jazeera network following the feud between Saudi Arabia, its allies, and Qatar. Later in the program, we pay tribute to prominent media scholar Professor Jack Shaheen, who passed away on July 9th at the age of 81. Professor Shaheen's seminal work, Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People, tells the long history of vilification of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans on the silver screen. All this coming up. Stay with us.
Last month, Saudi Arabia and its allies, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, cut off all diplomatic and economic ties with Qatar and imposed a land and air blockade under the pretext of Qatar's alleged support for, quote, terrorism. Soon after, these countries turned the screws on Qatar by giving it 10 days to comply to a list of 13 demands. The deadline came and went, and the standoff continues as the Saudis have deemed Qatar's response to its demands as, quote, overall negative and lacking any content. According to news reports, the list of demands includes a dictate to shut down the Al Jazeera network and all media outlets funded by Qatar directly or indirectly, such as Arabi 21, Middle East Eye, Al Arabi Al Jadid, or The New Arab, and RAST. Last week, I spoke with Professor Adel Iskandar of Simon Fraser University about the backdrop to the conflict and the history of Al Jazeera network in its early years, focusing on Al Jazeera Arabic, which was launched in 1996. This week, we continue the conversation by tracing the history of Al Jazeera English and its break from the editorial style of its Arabic counterpart. Adel Iskandar is an assistant professor of global communications at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. He's the author, co-author, and editor of several works, including Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution, and Al Jazeera, the story of the network that is rattling governments and redefining modern journalism. He's also co-editor of Jadalia Online.
So the English language network, when it came into being, was set up in such a way, to the chagrin of some people who were big fans of the Arabic network during its early days, was set up to essentially mirror the BBC, only with a focus on the global south. They were, one of the early slogans was, everybody watches CNN, but who is CNN watching? And so the idea here is that they are more connected to the local news than foreign correspondents. So the impetus behind it and the message behind it is that we are going local. We are doing local or hyperlocal, or we're bringing in journalists who are reporting from their milieus, their atmospheres, their context, their experiences, their countries. And that's going to give us an unvarnished view of the realities of these particular places. But at the same time, with the strong funding that is not unlike a major private network, major corporate network. So with $1 billion later and 4 broadcast studios in Washington, D.C., London, Doha, and Kuala Lumpur, the station was really a force to be reckoned with from the moment that it came into being. Any news that they would cover would become news. And you would remember, I don't know if you will recall, but for some time they had this slogan that said, setting the news agenda. Hmm. That was their slogan. And it is quite correct. If you're that substantial, that large, that kind of reach, and they were able to pay their way into various markets in Europe and in sub-Saharan Africa and in North America and elsewhere, that has really given them a massive push and created tremendous amount of visibility for the product itself. The product was intriguing because these areas were presented in a way that was much more nuanced, much more contextual, much more sophisticated, and much more historically grounded than any of the coverage that existed prior. And the long form, the commitment to not rushing or not reducing the discussion to sound bites, and also opening discussions, like long open-ended conversations about circumstances in these countries, set it aside and really helped create a large and growing audience for the station. But like any experiment, it does have its downside. And I think that downside is very much connected to what happened in the Middle East during and after the uprisings. Like any network that happens to find itself literally at the heart of a story, and Al Jazeera English, because of its immense reach and the large number of bureaus that they had all over the world, wherever there was a story, Al Jazeera happened to be there. It would take CNN or BBC or The Guardian or New York Times a day or two to even get someone on site, whereas Al Jazeera was literally there as events unfolded everywhere. That is the advantage of having such a massive budget, an open-ended budget, in fact. Like, nobody knows what the budget for Al Jazeera is. Al Jazeera English alone was created with $1 billion worth of operations. So we're talking about billions of dollars spent literally every year to keep this operation going. So, and their salaries are relatively competitive, admittedly, compared to most other operations. So all this to say that Al Jazeera was always in the right place at the right time. And when it came to the uprisings, I mean, they were literally at the epicenter of most of these protest movements. They were in Tahrir Square the vast majority of the time. Now, other reporters and other journalists and other organizations arrived as well, but no one spoke English and could relay the intricacies of the circumstances in a country like Egypt, quite like Al Jazeera English. Mm. So that became their, I would say actually it was kind of their swan song, because shortly thereafter, a few months later, we had the Syrian uprising turned civil war, and that quickly, as I said, devolved and became very complicated. By that point, I think there was an element of groupthink within the Al Jazeera network and a sort of an overzealousness and an excitement about scooping the world, if you will, scooping the world's media around these uprisings. And then, of course, if they turned into full-on militarized conflicts, then who does war correspondency in the Middle East better than Al Jazeera? So essentially, these were their stories to cover. And
also, Adel, they were really successful and interested in amplifying the voices of ordinary people on the streets of the Arab world.
This is also a function of the way in which they approach journalism. They were looking at it from the bottom up. Mm. They were interested in participatory journalism. They were interested in the vivid experiential aspects of coverage. They were very keen on making sure that journalists are local in those places. So the journalists are local, the stories are local, and there was plenty of time to cover them. So all of this became really captivating, particularly in the region.
And but also during the war in Iraq, they were the only ones that showed the horror of the war, which made them a target for the Bush administration, and they bombed their facility in Baghdad.
Absolutely. They were bombed in Baghdad, and they also bombed in Afghanistan.
And in Afghanistan, yes.
In fact, another under-discussed issue is the extent to which Al Jazeera English has been able to successfully cover the multiple wars in Gaza, as well as the various kind of bombing campaigns against in Lebanon in 2006. So Al Jazeera has been really at the forefront of the U.S. military might and imperial intervention for many, many years in the region. Now, the irony of all of this, again, just to kind of contextualize this to listeners, is that virtually all, I would say at least 90% of all aerial bombing campaigns in the Middle East had aircrafts that departed or at least refueled at the Udaid Air Force Base in Doha, Qatar, which is not very far at all from Al Jazeera's headquarters. So all of this is to say that Al Jazeera was able to show that it can do things that a typical news organization shouldn't, given its proximity to a strong ally of the United States, which, of course, added to its accolades. And admittedly, you know, one has to give credit where credit is due. The station has received a huge host of international awards in journalism for the work that they've done. And some of the work is so stellar and so precise and so moving that it's the type of stuff that will live on for decades to come. Like there's really a massive archive of phenomenal journalism produced by Al Jazeera English over the years. But at the same time, having said that, the region itself is now sort of imploding in complicated ways that has rendered the Al Jazeera product far less appealing and far less interesting to audiences. There's a growing, not only a disenchantment, but an almost fatalism when it comes to watching Al Jazeera's content nowadays. People are not looking for nuance, but rather there's a fair amount of sort of self-driven, self-absorbed, narcissistic, like contrarian politics that is happening. And people are no longer watching the news on Al Jazeera or elsewhere with the same kind of deciphering lens. There's a lot of dismissiveness. People watch news on Al Jazeera and other networks and say, well, this is just fake news, or this isn't real, or this particular reporting is not true, or it's false in a number of ways. And that has really hurt our ability to relay with any degree of conviction the emotional appeal and the emotional experiences that people are living out in the region today.
There are those who argue what you're saying about Al Jazeera is not really limited to Al Jazeera. Many media organizations, to some degree, of course, some of them are controlled by the state, like, for example, RT or Press TV that is transmitted out of Iran, or Al Alam. But big media organizations are either funded and owned by multinational corporations or the state or political interests. So why single out Al Jazeera? Why should we look at Al Jazeera in an exceptional way?
You're absolutely right. I think the problem is precisely around exceptionalizing Al Jazeera. But admittedly, we've all participated in this sort of exceptionalizing of Al Jazeera. The fact that it was perceived as the only network in the region to be doing what it does, the fact that it may be perceived as the only station producing content from the global south, the fact that it's perceived to be the only network willing to commit a sizable proportion of its journalists to covering some of the least perhaps compelling stories from areas of the world that are rarely discussed. These are all things that have rendered our perception, our view of Al Jazeera as exceptional. But when it comes to the political economic structure of the station and its existence in a geopolitical circumstance that has media organizations either, you know, serving corporate interests or statist interests, Al Jazeera is not just not exceptional. They are literally the same as virtually any other network in the region today. So you're right. There's nothing exceptional about Al Jazeera today, but we've had to arrive at that. Mm. And we've arrived at it as a function of the way in which their coverage has shifted. If it weren't for this shift in coverage, we would still be talking about how Al Jazeera is exceptional. But today, Al Jazeera is the other side of the coin for various other networks in the region, like Al Alam from Iran, Press TV, even networks like Mayadeen, which supports the Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian regime, and Al Arabiya broadcasting very positive and complimentary messaging about Saudi Arabia, or some of the Egyptian private networks, of which there are at least 20 or 30, all of whom are responsible for making sure that the Egyptian regime is presented in the most positive light. So really, they are all essentially the same. But there was a time when Al Jazeera was perceived as exceptional. And I have to say that I'm myself and many other scholars who started working on Al Jazeera from its inception are responsible for this exceptionalizing. By merely looking at the subtitles of my works on Al Jazeera that date back to the early 2000s, one of them is "The Story That Is Rattling Governments and Redefining Modern Journalism." I mean, that's pretty hyperbolic. It has been a humbling experience for the journalists in Al Jazeera who have over the years discovered that the sky is not the limit, that the pie is not in the sky. that you have to work within a structure that can be restrictive editorially, as well as various other impediments. Mm-hmm. But it's also been a wake-up call for a lot of scholars who were extremely enthusiastic about the networks in general, and then forcing us to really be much more empirical mm-hmm. in our analysis, so that we're not so knee-jerk and reactionary. And
also, part of it also was because it provided a very unique view on the events in the Middle East, and it served really as a vital news source for millions who lived under anti-democratic and repressive rules. So it was a place that they could go and get something else that was less suffocating than what they were getting on their state media.
That is correct. Although I have to say that whenever there are regional conflicts, you will often see that the news organizations on either side of the conflict are typically quite good at demonstrating and reflecting the oppositional voices on the other side. What Al Jazeera did well is that it served as a platform for critical journalism for the entire region, that it was doing so in a fairly even-handed, egalitarian way towards everyone, short of Qatar, of course. And that has quickly dissipated. And with that dissipation, the view of the network as a station that is able to do so with independence has also become a lot more opaque.
So how would you describe Al Jazeera English? Where would you place Al Jazeera English in the very populated, polarized media ecosystem that we are faced with today, and specifically in the Middle East, with repressive governments trying to control the media, jail journalists?
I mean, I would say that Al Jazeera English is an absolutely necessary part of the media landscape today. I think if it were to cease to exist or to be shut down or to be shackled in some ways, it would be a fairly significant loss for anyone who values unfettered access to the experiential lives of human beings around the world in some of the world's hotspots, but are in some ways being sidelined or subordinated to the more trend-setting metropolises. So I think that the loss of Al Jazeera would be a big deal. It is a really, really substantial player. Having said that, there's a lot that Al Jazeera English can do to improve the quality of its work. And as I've said, in 2002 and 2003, when I first started doing research on Al Jazeera, the key here is for them to be independent from Qatari foreign policy. If Al Jazeera English is able to avoid the pitfalls of Al Jazeera Arabic, then not only will they weather the storm, they will also be able to perhaps be the exceptional network that people want them to be.
But is that even possible?
No, at this point, I don't think it's possible. I think this is pure utopia. But nevertheless, one has to take into consideration that Al Jazeera is at least far better and far more substantial and far more worthwhile a network than many of its competitors on a global scale, especially when it comes to the region. But of course, that is not mirrored by the Arabic network locally. That's, I think, one of those circumstances. If anything, I think another lesson that could be learned, there was a time when everyone was saying Al Jazeera Arabic is so fantastic, there should definitely be an English network. Now I think we're at the point where we want the Arabic network to mirror the values and approach of the English network. There's a lot that the Arabic network can learn from the quality and the wherewithal and the stature of the English network at this point.
So what has been the reaction in the region to Saudi Arabia demanding the closure of Al Jazeera?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think besides a fair amount of conflicted and confrontational and sort of contested conversation that's happening in the social media and a few articles here and there, by and large, it's been rather quiet. The supporters of the network, many of whom at this point, the Arabic network specifically, many of whom happen to be either supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood or various other Islamist groups, have been much more vocal in their defense of the network and the need for them to continue existing. Also, the Palestinian community online has been especially vocal in their defense of Al Jazeera, because Al Jazeera has done amazing things in placing Palestine as front and center in many of the regional quagmires. Besides that, it's been really rather quiet. The chorus is much louder internationally, in fact, with Reporters Without Borders, Committee for the Protection of Journalists, and various other international Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and various other organizations and civil society organizations coming out and declaring their support for Al Jazeera's continuation, condemning any challenge to that. But in the region, it's been rather quiet, which I think is exactly what the GCC countries and Egypt have been banking on. They realize that they're doing this at a time when the total audience market share for Al Jazeera Arabic is probably at its lowest. The repercussions and the overall popular response is likely going to be muted.
What about independent, local, and progressive media outlets? What about them? Have you seen any reaction coming from those outlets?
Many of them have come out and reported the story, but did so without the desire to find themselves in the same boat as Al Jazeera. Again, it depends on their political stripe. Many of those independent news organizations typically fall left of center, which means that many of them have at some point in the last few years found themselves at odds with Al Jazeera's coverage because of its more center-right leaning approach to doing things. So even though they come to the defense of journalistic freedom, they typically don't come out in full support. Also because they themselves are seeing the space in which they can operate being increasingly suffocated. So the last thing that they want is to follow in the footsteps of Al Jazeera. Keep in mind, Al Jazeera is a substantial network with a huge budget operating in a sovereign state. Those independent organizations are much smaller and don't have the means. Mm-hmm. And so they're extremely vulnerable and precarious in comparison. It makes sense for them to walk a very fine line by not being so vocal in their support of Al Jazeera. But they nevertheless have demonstrated their condemnation, lightly noted, but their condemnation of this process. But they unfortunately do not represent a large enough constituency of readership, at least not enough to reverse what the GCC countries are doing as far as their course seems to demonstrate.
How do you think this 20-year-old experiment has changed the media landscape in the Middle East, and also people's expectations about the type of news and information that they need to get from their media?
Well, I think the experiment itself has had some really remarkable effect on the region. Now we have a real interest, a curiosity in journalism that is not necessarily beholden to either corporate interests or state interests or regime interests. We also have a genuine interest in investigative reporting, a genuine interest in open political debate. All of these things are now enshrined in the audience's expectations, and that is not something that will go away. Even if Al Jazeera was to cease to exist for whatever reason, perhaps this pressure or otherwise, the seeds have already been sowed. That's going to live on indefinitely. And I think Al Jazeera will get credit for having not only incentivized this, but essentially laying down the tracks for this type of transformation. And that translates into a generation of journalists from Al Jazeera or having been trained at Al Jazeera Journalism Academy or people who have watched Al Jazeera and emulated it. So it's a generation of people, both as audiences and as professionals, who are now enriching their respective media systems in their own countries and in their own communities. So that's something Al Jazeera to be credited for and will have a long-term effect.
In 2014, Al Jazeera Media Network launched its online only channel called AJ Plus. So what do you think about AJ Plus's performance and content and the fact that it has tried to reach an audience that is both young and increasingly mobile?
AJ Plus was Al Jazeera's answer to what it was described at the time as the blunder of Al Jazeera America, going for cable at a time when most people were moving online. Al Jazeera America ended up shutting down after a short number of years, but AJ Plus was perfectly timed and very nimble, very sharp, beautifully curated short video packages that serve as news explainers, and in some cases short reports, and also vox populi type interviews with people in the streets or in a particular incident or at an event. All of those have been really, really popular, and AJ Plus has really marked itself as a worthwhile production in that regard. But it is a very competitive field, and in the online spaces, if you strike gold, everybody's going to be at the mine. So the competition has been so large and so vast and so aggressive that the market share for AJ Plus is shrinking the more players there are in the field. And so now you have at least somewhere between 5 and 10 news organizations are moving in that direction anyway. BBC and The Guardian and everyone else is producing these short video packages. But there are some companies that are doing just that, producing short video clips. And those are immensely popular. So now the brand of Al Jazeera will continue to be the type of content that they're curating for those videos. But the medium itself or the genre itself is no longer unique. And that's essentially how Al Jazeera has been operating. They break new ground and then everybody else joins. And in many instances, they watch themselves lose market share gradually and then try to figure out what the next big thing might be. AJ Plus has done an amazing job, I have to say. And I hope that your listeners are familiar with it. And if not, they should be. But nevertheless, it is becoming increasingly competitive. But that's their way of tapping into a different audience share.
Yeah.
And they will continue to reinvent these new audiences. So for instance, the Al Jazeera family of networks also launched a huge, really, that I think is probably their largest investment up to this point, is a group of networks called BN Sports. And BN Sports is really a colossal undertaking. It's an all sports networks that you have to purchase a device, and it allows you to access all of BN's live coverage of sports. It's predominantly soccer. So that's how they've been able to break into markets in Europe and in Latin America. And they have exclusive rights to coverage of many of the leagues around the world. And that's a very, very different kind of investment. But that's also part of the Al Jazeera family of networks, and also is another way in which the Qatari government, or Qatar as a country, wields its influence politically through sports and diplomacy alongside news. In essence, the ingenuity and the innovation and the creativity and the constant kind of paying attention to where the trends might be on the part of the upper management at Al Jazeera is quite admirable. But nevertheless, one has to keep in mind that even though the intention is not to generate money, because the profit is not necessarily the intention here, but rather the influence, that should also kind of raise questions as to what it is that either Al Jazeera or the Qatari government wish to do.
We are not exactly sure how this conflict or this crisis is going to resolve itself. But what do you think Al Jazeera is going to look like if it survives the Saudis' assault? What type of journalism do you think we should expect from Al Jazeera based on what we are witnessing right now?
Well, it still forces me to do some forecasting, but I suspect that if Al Jazeera were to survive, it sort of won't survive, because if it outlives this particular circumstance, it will almost certainly have to submit to certain concessions. And these concessions would translate into a far less clawless and defanged organization that's not capable of doing what it was set out to do. And if it relents to and capitulates to pressures from Gulf countries and Egypt and others, it will cease to be what Al Jazeera was meant to be at the outset. So I don't think that they will necessarily survive if they continue. I think that there is a good possibility that Al Jazeera English will weather the storm, because I don't think that they are necessarily the target of this particular attack, but they will almost certainly need to change their tone with regards to Saudi Arabia and to sort of disown or repent from the kind of coverage that has happened over the last month or so.
This is a very, work in progress.
It is a work in progress, and it's a very difficult time for Al Jazeera and for anyone who works in it or has been an avid follower of the network. This is really an existential crisis.
Adel, I want us to end on a positive note. A couple of years ago, you and I were at a conference in Beirut in Lebanon, where we saw amazing, amazing journalists, Lebanese, Egyptian, Jordanian, Tunisian journalists, Bahraini journalists, and they were doing environmental investigative journalism. They were covering social, political, local issues, and they were training new journalists. So tell us about some exciting new local, independent, progressive journalism that is coming out of the Middle East and North Africa that we should pay more attention to, as opposed to focusing only on a specific premier and big news organizations.
Thank you for ending on this note, Maliha. I think you're absolutely right. We're so busy looking at these sort of larger geopolitical patterns and trends and obsessing over the larger news organizations, when in reality, the trenches are really about the direct one-on-one experiences that people have at a basic community level. And honestly, I think there's no time that's more exciting than today in the region, because as these larger networks begin to consolidate and start sounding more alike, we start seeing these incredible organic experiences in local and community journalism proliferate all over the region. In Egypt, of course, the more notable example is Mada Masr, exactly. But there are many other examples of smaller community newspapers and networks and community radio shows that are popping up, and YouTube channels where people are producing their own news, essentially. And we're talking about places that have not been known for news production at all. Places in the Nile Delta in the north, south of Alexandria, or all the way down to Upper Egypt in places like Qena. It's a really exciting time. The same thing is happening in Tunisia, where the four or five top corporate and state news organizations are no longer where people get their news. Instead, they're turning to community radio stations in their respective towns and villages, and that there is a real thriving journalism online. Take, for instance, in Jordan, where you have a very, very concentrated media system that is governed by a very draconian legal system that suffocates any media practice. And despite that, there are organizations like Heber, which has focused its coverage on the most disenfranchised and most progressive voices in cities like Amman, but also branching out to Zarqa and Salt and places that were essentially off the radar completely. Mm. Even in countries like Iraq, where you have at least 30 years worth of death and destruction, have somehow been able to produce a thriving online journalism, whether it's in the north, in Kirkuk, or all the way down south in Basra. You have new experiments in media production and journalism that we're not privy to here. And many of them are in Arabic, so we won't be able to really follow them unless you understand the language.
But nevertheless, also in Syria, Adel, where absolutely, they are trying to be witness and tell us about the horrors of this war under the most difficult circumstances.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's so many amazing experiences and people who have put their lives at risk to bring forth phenomenal stories, and for a small number of audiences. But that is the incremental growth, and that is the grassroots growth of journalism in the region. As exciting as Al Jazeera has been over the last 21 years, it is functionally a top-down news organization created by some of the wealthiest people in the region to essentially dictate specific agendas. They provided voices, but these voices are now more and more being empowered to take matters and the instruments and the tools of media production and journalism production into their own hands. And that is part of the reason why journalism moving forward in the Middle East is going to be far more exciting in the next 21 years.
That was Professor Iskander speaking with Melihi Razazan about the Saudi-Qatar crisis and why Al Jazeera network has become such a target for Saudi Arabia and its allies. Adel Iskander is an assistant professor of global communications at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. He is the author, co-author, and editor of several works, including Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution, and Al Jazeera, the story of the network that is rattling governments and redefining modern journalism. He's also co-editor of Jadalia Electronic Magazine.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can always reach us via our website at vomena.org/blog or send us an email at info@vomena.org. You can friend us on our Facebook or find us on Twitter at twitter.com/vomena_radio.
On July 9th, world-renowned Arab-American scholar Professor Jack Shaheen died at the age of 81. Dr. Shaheen spent much of his life battling stereotypes of Arab-Americans and Muslims in American pop culture, and as he put it, quote, a dangerously consistent pattern of hateful Arab stereotypes that rob an entire people of their humanity. His works include The TV Arab, Guilty, Hollywood's Verdict on Arabs After 9/11, and Arab and Muslim Stereotyping in American Popular Culture. He is best known for authoring Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People, which was adapted as a documentary and for which he studied more than 1,000 Hollywood films over a span of more than a century. Here's an excerpt of the documentary Real Bad Arabs, in which Professor Shaheen discusses the history of vilification of Arabs and Muslims in Hollywood.
For 30 years, I've looked at how we, particularly when I say we, image makers, have projected Arabs on silver screens. In my latest book, Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People, I looked at more than 1,000 films. Films ranging from the earliest, most obscure days of Hollywood to today's biggest blockbuster. And what I tried to do is to make visible what too many of us seem not to see. A dangerously consistent pattern of hateful Arab stereotypes. Stereotypes that rob an entire people of their humanity. All aspects of our culture project the Arab as villain. That is a given. There is no deviation. We have taken a few structured images and repeated them over and over again.
You are hostages of the Holy Freedom Party.
Whether one lives in Paducah, Kentucky, or Wood River, Illinois, we know basically the same thing.
Listen to the sound, Jesus, of our talk.
We know the mythology. The mythology, namely Hollywood's images of Arabs. inherited the Arab image primarily from Europeans. In the early days, you know, maybe 150 years, 200 years ago, the British and the French who traveled to the Middle East, and those who didn't travel to the Middle East, conjured up these images of the Arab as the Oriental other. The travel writers, the artists who fabricated these images and who were very successful, as a matter of fact. And these images were transmitted and inherited by us. We took them, we embellished them, and here they are.
When you cross the mountains of the moon into our country, Mr. Tyrone, you will be stepping back 2,000 years.
We have this fictional setting called Arab Land, a mythical theme park. And in Arab Land, you know, you have the ominous music, you have the desert. We start with the desert, always the desert as a threatening place. We add an oasis, palm trees, a palace that has a torture chamber in the basement. The Pasha sits there on his, you know, posh cushions with harem maidens surrounding him. None of the harem maidens please him, so they abduct the blonde heroine from the West who doesn't want to be seduced. When we visit Arab Land, we must be aware of the instant Alibaba kit. What we have the property masters of Hollywood going around, and they're cladding the women in see-through pantaloons, belly dancing outfits. They're giving the Arab villains scimitars, you know, these long, long scimitars. We see people riding around on magic carpets, turban charmers programming snakes in and out of baskets. Yesteryear's Arab Land is today's Arab Land.
You are late.
1,000 apologies, oh patient one.
You have it then.
I had to slit a few throats, but I got it.
Disney's Aladdin was seen by millions of children worldwide. It was hailed as one of Disney's finest accomplishments. But the film recycled every old degrading stereotype from Hollywood's silent black and white past.
Oh, I come from a land, from a faraway place, where the caravan camels roam, where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home.
Where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home. Now, how could a producer with a modicum of intelligence, just a modicum of sensitivity, let a song such as that open the film? But this moves way beyond one song.
You must be hungry. Here you go.
You'd better be able to pay for that.
Do you know what the penalty is for stealing?
No, no, please.
The Arab is one-dimensional caricature. Cartoon cutouts used by filmmakers as stock villains and as comic relief. And so over and over we see Arabs in movies portrayed as buffoons, their only purpose being to deliver cheap laughs. You see this in the Joey Heatherton film, The Happy Hooker Goes to Washington.
Every night I was forced to perform unspeakable acts with circumcised dogs.
Well, dogs are better than sheep. They're cleaner, I know, I've tried both.
And over again, they're portrayed as inept. So, in a movie like True Lies, not only are the Arabs dangerous, they're also incompetent.
We are all prepared to die. One turn of that key, 2 million of your people will die instantly.
What key?
That key! Who's taking the key?
One actor who excels in his portrayal of Arabs as buffoons is Jamie Farr in Cannonball Run 2.
I have a weakness for blondes and women without mustaches.
All the stereotypes are here. Too rich and stupid to know the value of money.
Get me 12 suites. Better yet, the entire floor.
And of course, he's oversexed, lecherous, uncontrollably obsessed with the American woman.
Here, my desert blossom. Give the change. Have you ever considered joining a harem?
And so another pattern is the lecherous Arab. In Jewel of the Nile, Sheikh Omar tricks Kathleen Turner. How? He convinces her to come with him to Arab land. Then he imprisons her.
You stay here and you write what I tell you to write.
We see the same sort of ominous seduction and protocol. The entire plot revolves around an Arab emir's infatuation with the blonde, blue-eyed Goldie Hawn. In the Bond film, Never Say Never Again, Kim Basinger is abused by the most sleazy-looking Arabs imaginable. She's tied to a pole, stripped to her underwear, and auctioned off to primitive-looking Bedouins. And in Sahara, Brooke Shields is also kidnapped and presented to the lecherous Arab sheikh for his own perverted pleasure.
Get away from me, you dirty bitch!
More than 300 movies. Nearly 25% of all Hollywood movies that in one way or another demean Arabs contain gratuitous slurs, or they portray Arabs as being the butt of a cheap joke.
We were going in a Mecca scene, and the plane is full of Arabs with these animals. Goats, sheep, chickens. I mean, they don't go anywhere without their goddamn animals. We had to put plastic in the cabins. You know, they urinate, they defecate.
You have films by Neil Simon, like Chapter 2. The beginning of the film, the protagonist arrives back from London, and his brother says, "How was London?" And he says, "Full of Arabs."
"How was London?" "Full of Arabs."
Well, imagine if he had said, "Full of blacks, full of Jews, full of Hispanics." I mean, that's ridiculous. Why do we do these things?
We got a bite.
One of the most offensive films with the gratuitous images, Father of the Bride 2. It features Steve Martin selling his house to a Mr. Habib.
"Justin, we like house very much. When you can move out."
"Excuse me?"
"The Habibs would like to buy the house, George. It's exactly what they've been looking for."
"Yes, when you can move. We need house a week from Wednesday, and my wife wants flour dishes in kitchen. You sell, we pay top dollar."
When Habib's submissive wife tries to speak, he shouts gibberish at her. And then he offers Martin a $15,000 cash bonus to move out in 10 days.
Making real estate history here, George.
When Martin tells Mr. Habib that he doesn't want to sell the house after all, he finds Habib's wrecking crew there, ready to demolish his beautiful home. And in a scene that calls to mind one of the most degrading stereotypes of the Jewish people, Mr. Habib demands an extra $100,000 to sell the house that he has owned for just a day back to Martin.
"You want me to take out a loan on something I owned free and clear just 24 hours ago?"
"Well, that is up to you, George. Your path, your fence, your memories."
Now, if you looked at the other Father of the Bride films, Elizabeth Taylor, Spencer Tracy, there were no Arabs or Arab Americans. So why does Disney inject these horrific, sort of offensive characters in Father of the Bride Part 2? It's the same reason that in Gladiator, the slave traders who kidnap Russell Crowe and bring him back to Rome are Arabs.
Right.
I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, why does Hollywood inject Arabs, scenes of Arabs, and or slurs demeaning Arabs, and movies having nothing to do with the Middle East? So you're sitting like I am, for example, watching Back to the Future.
Oh, my God.
About a mad scientist.
Tell me, I don't know how.
And yet, early on in the film, we see these ugly, inept Libyans with machine guns in a parking lot trying to gun down the protagonist. I mean, why? This movie wasn't about the future. It was the same old stereotyping from the past. And the same goes for Hollywood's view of Arab women. The Arab woman today is bright, intelligent. She's someone who is exceeding in all professions. And yet this reality still is being denied us on silver screens. The highly sexualized belly dancer has been with us from the beginning of Hollywood's history, inspired by early images of the Orient as the place of exoticism, intrigue, and passion. But in recent years, this image has dramatically changed. The Arab woman is now projected as a bomber, a terrorist. Added to this image is what I call bundles in black. Veiled women in the background, in the shadows, submissive. It seems the more Arab women advance, the more Hollywood keeps them locked in the past. Politics and Hollywood's images are linked. They reinforce one another. Policy enforces mythical images. Mythical images help enforce policy. Jack Valente, president of the Motion Picture Association of America, has said, quote, Washington and Hollywood spring from the same DNA, end quote. The Arab image began to change immediately after World War II. There were three things that impacted the change. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict, in which the United States has unequivocally supported Israel. The Arab oil embargo in the 70s, which angered Americans when gas prices went through the ceiling. And the Iranian Revolution, which increased Arab-American tensions when Iranian students took American diplomats hostage for more than a year. These three pivotal events brought the Middle East into the living rooms of Americans and together helped shape the way movies stereotyped Arabs and the Arab world. One of the primary changes, the image of the Sheikh. In a movie such as Rollover, he's out to take over the world with his money, where he's up to no good trying to buy chunks of America.
Mrs. Winters, I think I should tell you there are those in the family who do not think we should be making this offer at all. I assume if you could have found venture capital of this sort for a company like Winterchem in America, you would not be coming all the way to Arabia looking for it.
You see the oily sheikh in Spielberg's Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. You see the money-grubbing sheikh who's out to commit all kinds of terrorism and launch a missile in earnest in the army.
Gentlemen, behold my special club, the Pluton missile. With it, I will bring the infidels to their knees and be leader in the Arab world.
One of the myths in the 70s was that the Arabs are coming over, buying up chunks of America. And, of course, this was reflected in the cinema.
The Arabs have taken billions of dollars out of this country, and now they must put it back.
One of my favorite movies of all time, racist though it may be, is Network, about commercial television.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it. How do you feel?
We're mad as hell!
Network features a TV anchor rising to superstardom. How? He unleashes wild rants against the system on the air. But he directs the angriest of all his rants at Arabs, who he says are buying up America.
They're buying it for the Saudi Arabian Investment Corporation. They're buying it for the Arabs.
The anchor, Howard Beale, calls on the American people to rise up and stop the Arab buyout of his TV network.
Listen to me, goddammit. The Arabs are simply buying us. There's only one thing that can stop them. You.
The rage of Americans in response became one of the most famous scenes in movie history.
I want you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and write a telegram to President Ford saying, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
This kind of anger, the anger born of fear, all of it in response to a perceived conspiracy and threat by a specific group of people, well, we've seen and heard this before. If we look at the anti-Semitic propaganda of the Nazis, at its core is an identical type of economic threat. This economic myth even made its way into children's books. Sadly, the popular image of Jews in Nazi propaganda resembles the popular image of Arabs in some of our most beloved Hollywood movies. The only difference being that the Arab usually wears a robe and headdress.
On July 9th, world-renowned Arab-American scholar Professor Jack Shaheen died at the age of 81. That was an excerpt from the documentary Real Bad Arabs about the history of vilification of Arabs and Muslims in Hollywood, which was based on his seminal book by the same name. For more information about this week's program, visit vomina.org. That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632. Email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Naomi Oreskes, The Scientist as Sentinel. Professor Naomi Oreskes says that scientists are often reluctant to speak in public on contested issues. They fear that this will politicize their science and have a negative impact on their credibility. Herself outspoken on climate change, she explored historical examples of scientists who have spoken up on issues of broad importance, including nuclear weapons, ozone depletion, and climate change. In this talk, she addresses issues of professional risk versus a population's need and right to know. Is there such a thing as an obligation to speak on issues that might not be understood or even recognized? And what may be the limits of what a scientist can accomplish? When she gave this talk on The Scientist as Sentinel to her colleagues at Harvard in March 2017, She responded to an issue on everybody's mind. How has the role of a scientist changed under the Trump administration? And who among Harvard's faculty was going to participate in the March for Science? Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor, Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard. Her 2010 book, Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco to Global Warming, co-authored with Eric Conway, received the 2011 prize from the History of Science Society. The book was made into a film and released in 2014. Also in 2014, her most recent book was published, entitled The Collapse of Western Civilization. Here's Naomi Oreskes.
What I want to talk to you about is what the role of scientists should really be in relation to talking about contested public policy issues. I developed this talk as a talk about science for scientists. So in this talk, I'm going to use the word we when I refer to scientists. For those of you who aren't scientists, you can just say they. But the message, I think, is relevant for all of us in thinking through what our role needs to be in terms of thinking about contested issues of public policy. So some of you may have, and I'm going to come out from behind this podium because I don't like podiums. I don't like to be separated from my people. So to us, it's obvious that the public ignores expertise at its peril. And as people associated with a great university like Harvard, we have an expectation that our expertise should be respected and in many cases acted on. But as we've seen of late, many of our political leaders not only don't act on our expertise, but they actually reject it. And in some cases, they actively misrepresent it. And that creates a very difficult situation for us. What should we do when our work, our expertise, is being rejected, disparaged, and in some cases misrepresented? Should we speak up in public? Should we be speaking up in public on tricky, sensitive topics like evolution or, in my case, climate change? And if so, how? And what exactly does it mean to say that we should respect expertise? What are the boundaries of expertise? And if we, as experts, embrace a public role, what does that entail? So I want to start by talking about a scientist that I've studied in some detail, a man by the name of Roger Revelle. How many of you have heard of Revelle before? Oh, a lot. Wow, this is a great audience. Okay. And not just the earth science professors. So Revelle, as many of you know, is a very famous chemical oceanographer. He was also one of the directors of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego, and he was also the mentor to Al Gore. It's because of Roger Revelle that Al Gore first learned about climate change and began to think of it about it as a serious issue. In 1965, Revelle was serving as part of the President's Science Advisory Committee, a group that was writing a report on the state of the environment. And this report had an appendix that was co-authored with four of his prominent geoscientific colleagues, including Dave Keeling. And the title of this appendix was Atmospheric CO2, the Invisible Pollutant. And in this appendix, Revelle and his colleagues warned that in due course, not tomorrow, not next year, but in due course, increased atmospheric carbon dioxide would likely alter the climate in serious and adverse ways. They wrote, throughout his worldwide industrial civilization, man is unwittingly conducting a vast geophysical experiment. By the year 2000, the increase in atmospheric CO2 will be close to 25%. This may be sufficient to produce measurable and perhaps marked changes in climate. And as we all know today now, that prediction came true. So we can say that these leading scientists of a previous generation were acting as sentinels. They were calling attention to an issue that was not yet publicly recognized, in fact, not even recognized by most of their scientific colleagues at this time. And they were pointing out that while the issue of visible pollution was getting a lot of attention in the media and in halls of power, particularly smog in Los Angeles or the terrible London fogs that had killed people in the 1950s, there were other invisible pollutants that were also important. And carbon dioxide was probably the most important of these invisible pollutants. So they reached out to political leaders, in this case to the President of the United States, about their scientific research that implied a societal threat. Now, in our research in the Revell archives, we've never found any evidence that Revell worried that this might somehow not be an appropriate thing to do. On the contrary, in the context of growing public concern about air pollution in the 1960s, Revell considered it to be obviously appropriate to alert political leaders to this other form of pollution that was not as obvious but could also have serious long-term effects. We also have seen from our research that most of the political leaders to whom he reached out did seem to be at least cautiously receptive to being made aware of this issue. And in current research that I'm doing here with two of my graduate students here at Harvard in the History of Science Department, Hannah Conway and Colleen Lanier Christensen, we've identified a number of political leaders in the 1960s who took an interest in this issue and who thanked Revell and his colleagues for sending these materials to them and in some cases followed up and asked for more information. It was a very different time. Now, today, though, many of us are reluctant to be sentinels. Many of us are worried that if we speak up in public, beyond the confines of scientific publications or scientific meetings and conferences, that this will lead to us being viewed as advocates or activists, and that we will politicize our science and will lose credibility. And many of you have heard this in the last few weeks. Maybe some of you have been involved in conversations with your students or your colleagues here at Harvard about whether we should participate in the March for Science and whether or not that threatens to politicize science in an undesirable way. So this is a question that colleagues and I have been looking at actually for a few years, well before the March on Science or March for Science or whatever. March on Science? No. I guess it's a March for Science. Donald Trump is marching on science. Well before the current political situation, my colleagues and I have been interested in this question of how scientists think about their role in relation to political questions. So I've been, for several years now, part of a project that's coming, wrapping up now, called Assessing Assessments. So in our work, this was one of the things that we asked scientists about. We asked them, how do you think about the relationship between science and policy, and how do you think about your role in relation to that question? And what we found was a very consistent pattern, where the vast majority of scientists that we asked expressed a great deal of reluctance to take on any role other than simply presenting factual information in the context of scientific assessments. So not expressing opinions on policy and not even presenting those facts in other contexts outside of the assessment framework. And when we probed this and asked why, many expressed the idea that there is or needs to be a bright line between science on the one hand and policy on the other, and that speaking up in public, even about the facts, threatens to dull that line. And therefore, scientists said things like, well, you should do your work, but you should not go public. Some said, using imperative, you must not go public. You must not cross the line. And when we said, well, why, they said, well, because if you do, you'll lose your credibility. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has addressed this issue explicitly through its rubric of being policy relevant but not policy prescriptive. IPCC leaders acknowledge that their work is not pure science, that climate science is linked to major public policy issues, and that the IPCC exists because of its link to governance through the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. But nevertheless, even though they acknowledge that the IPCC itself is a kind of hybrid organization, most climate scientists working within the IPCC still say that they should refrain from taking any kind of public role and stay removed from discussion of policy implications and considerations. And one of the most common refrains that we've heard, both in the context of this research and more broadly, is scientists saying that we should let the facts speak for themselves. Now, our climate science colleague, James Hansen, has also written about this issue, and he's referred to this as reticence. He said that scientists in general are reluctant to speak up about what they know about climate change, so not just about the policy things, but even to speak up in public about the facts, and again, because they believe that we need to let the facts speak for themselves. Now, those of you who saw the poster for this talk saw that one of the pictures on it is this picture of Jim Hansen getting arrested, protesting at the White House over the lack of action on climate change. Many scientists who we have spoken to have invoked Jim Hansen as proof. Now, Hansen has become a major figure not only because he speaks up about the evidence of climate change, which he does, but also because he's become an advocate for particular solutions. So he is an advocate for a carbon price established through a fee and dividend system. And in support of this work, he has been arrested several times. But I want to ask the question tonight, what exactly is Hansen proof of, other than maybe that scientists are uncomfortable with his position? And it's not just climate science. This is an issue that affects scientists in many, many areas. So people who work in marine biology and conservation, people who study lead or other toxics in the environment, endocrine-disrupting chemicals, neonicotinoid pesticides and their potential impacts on pollinators, genetically modified crops, vaccine safety, the harms of sugar in the American diet, deaths and injury from gun violence. All of these are issues on which scientists do scientific work, collect data, factual information, but they have policy implications that may be highly contested. So scientists in many fields face the sentinel problem. And I want to argue that scientists in the past have faced this problem too, that although this moment we're living in may feel unique, it certainly feels distinctive and troubling in our lifetimes, but it isn't actually a unique moment in terms of scientists facing this question of what their role should be. So we could think of this problem as having a kind of spectrum of choices. At one end, we might say, as many scientists do say, that we should just do our science and leave it to others to communicate it, to explain why it matters, and where needed to propose remedies. And we could call this the pure science ideal. At the other end, we could think about Jim Hansen, who does speak out, does get involved, does propose remedies, and in his case, does even get arrested. We could call that the activist ideal. So what I want to do tonight is to argue for a middle ground. Now, as a person who works on climate change, I adamantly reject the idea that the truth is always in the middle, because it's often not. But tonight, I do want to suggest that there is a kind of middle ground that we might think about occupying. And that in any case, thinking about the spectrum helps us think about where we want to be on that spectrum, because at the end of the day, there isn't actually a right or wrong answer to this. These are judgments, but historical experience, historical evidence can help us make those judgments and help us judge where we want to be in relation to this question. So my argument tonight has three parts. The first is to talk about historical precedent, to look at an example of scientists in the past who did step up and act as sentinels, not just on the fact of the problem, but also on policy solutions, and to argue that this precedent refutes our worry or our anxiety that taking a public position on an urgent issue undermines the credibility of our science, and then to argue, to conclude, that I do believe we need to speak because facts don't, in fact, speak for themselves. So what is the historical precedent? Well, some of you may already know, maybe you've heard me talk before, but it's the precedent of nuclear weaponry. Many climate scientists feel that we are today in an existential crisis. Scientists in 1945 knew that they were. There was no question among physicists who worked on the Manhattan Project, who worked on nuclear weapons, that the potential for an arms race meant the potential to eliminate life on Earth as we knew it. And in this context, particularly as 1945 became 1948 and the Soviet Union exploded its first atomic bomb, and then the United States developed a hydrogen bomb, and then the Soviet Union developed a hydrogen bomb, and pretty soon we were in an arms race, many leading physicists felt that they had a moral obligation to speak out against nuclear proliferation. They had played an essential role in creating these weapons, and these weapons now threatened human safety and potentially even human survival. And therefore, they felt it was actually rather obvious that they had an obligation to raise an alarm and suggest means to control this threat. So drawing on the framework of scientific rationality, they argued that it was rational to be alarmed and irrational to be complacent. And therefore, they did have an obligation. But one of the interesting things about this discussion that takes place in the late 40s and 50s is that many of these physicists argue that their obligation is not just to speak up on the technical aspects of nuclear weaponry, to explain how they worked and how they killed people and why they were so damaging, but also to address the problem of what to do about them, about how to control them. Because to them, it was eminently clear that these things did need to be controlled. There was no real plausible argument that an unrestricted arms race would be a good thing for the world. The most famous example, as many of you know, is Niels Bohr, who spoke out actually even before the end of World War II and predicted the arms race that would follow if there were not some kind of international agreement between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And also Albert Einstein, who in later years famously became an advocate for international peace and arms control. But it wasn't just Bohr and Einstein. Sometimes people have said to me, well, Bohr could afford it. He was so famous. Or Einstein could afford to speak out. But it wasn't just these incredibly conspicuously famous figures. Actually, a wide range of physicists, Hans Bethe, Leo Szilard, James Franck, Philip Morrison, who taught for many years at MIT, and many, many others. There are dozens of physicists that we could name who became involved in a variety of different ways, large and small, to help alert the world to the threat of nuclear weapons and engage people in a conversation about arms control and disarmament. These men spoke to the moral imperative to control nuclear weapons, and they became advocates. The core of their argument is something that I've labeled epistemic proximity. And I think it's an important argument to understand because it's not just about a kind of moral obligation that arose from having built the weapons, but it also has specifically to do with their role as they understand it as experts. So the argument goes like this. It's not just that they helped build these weapons, but it's that as physicists, they had a uniquely vivid appreciation and understanding of the damage that these weapons could wreak. That they could explain things that other people really didn't and maybe even couldn't fully understand about what an arms race and a large-scale nuclear exchange would really mean. So people had seen the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. John Hersey had written about it very beautifully in his book, Hiroshima. But many people said, well, yes, it's true, lots of people died, but how is that worse or different than the firebombing in Dresden or the firebombing of Tokyo? So for many people, it wasn't actually clear why these weapons were substantially worse. Now, this seems hard to conceptualize today, but clearly, in the late 40s and 50s, that was not the case. Some of you may know that President Harry Truman, when confronted with the announcement of the Soviet atomic bomb, and when he was asked, well, does this mean there will be an arms race, he said, yes, and we will win it. Douglas MacArthur, during the Korean conflict, requested permission to use nuclear weapons. So it's not the case that people understood that using nuclear weapons would necessarily lead to some kind of terrible conflagration. So these scientists felt that the need to understand fully and viscerally what a large-scale nuclear exchange would mean, that this need was severe, and that they had to step up to that challenge. And many of them did so in both public and private ways. So I think a comparable argument can be made about climate change today. I've given something like 300 public talks on climate change, and I'm going to South Dakota tomorrow, so I now will have been to 47 of 50 states, and I've talked in Idaho and North Dakota and Texas and Oklahoma and California. And one of the things that I feel I've learned is that many people, including many people who do not deny climate change or do not disparage climate science, still don't really quite get why this issue really matters. They don't quite understand just how serious uncontrolled climate change will be. One of my colleagues, a quite famous and distinguished political scientist, said to me once over lunch, so tell me why I should be worried about polar bears? And this is partly why Eric Conway and I wrote The Collapse of Western Civilization, because we were trying to think about what could we do? What kind of story could we tell that would convey to people why climate change really matters and why this is not just a question of polar bears, as much as I personally do love and worry about polar bears? Okay, part two. I want to argue that this historical precedent offers evidence that refutes our worry that taking a public position on an urgent issue will undermine our scientific credibility. And this argument is actually extremely short. The evidence simply doesn't support this hypothesis. If we think about Albert Einstein, I know of no evidence, and maybe someone can come up with it, but I know of no evidence that the theory of relativity or his work on the photoelectric effect ever lost credibility because of his advocacy of arms control. Now, there were anti-Semites in Germany who didn't like Einstein, but that was not because of his public advocacy. That was because of a whole set of other complicated issues. Hans Bethe, as many of you know, won the Nobel Prize for his work on nuclear fusion. No one ever suggested revoking that prize or that somehow that work was doubted or dubious because he was an arms control advocate. And Bohr is such an interesting character. Some of you know, Many of Bohr's colleagues were dubious about the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. Bohr wrote a lot of philosophical essays that lots of his colleagues thought were completely off the rails. But it wasn't, but not his arms control advocacy. Millions of school children learned about the Bohr model of the atom. If you took high school physics or college physics, you learned about the liquid drop model of fission. You learned about his crucial scientific contributions. And no one ever said that those contributions were undermined because he advocated arms control. Now, what about Robert Oppenheimer, you know, a famous case of a scientist who got discredited? But what exactly happened to Oppenheimer? He lost his security clearance because of his opposition to the hydrogen bomb, and also because Edward Teller held a personal grudge against him and saw this as an opportunity to undermine him. So Oppenheimer lost political standing inside the U.S. government. He lost his clearance. He lost his capacity to give advice to political leaders. But losing political standing with politicians is a very different thing than losing scientific credibility. And in fact, Oppenheimer became a hero in many circles. I mean, many of you have heard of Oppenheimer because of this, more than because of his science. So among many people, he gained credibility. So when we talk about credibility, we actually have to be more precise. We have to ask, are we talking about credibility with political leaders? Are we talking about credibility with the public? Are we talking about credibility with our own colleagues? You know, or what? These are different things. There's no evidence that Oppenheimer lost scientific credibility with any of his colleagues because of this work. So I want to argue that the fear of losing scientific credibility is exactly that. It's a fear. It's an anxiety. And there's actually very little evidence to support the worry. And you can call me naive, but I do think we should be making our decisions based on evidence, even though I know that's a very controversial claim to make in this day and age. And some of you may have seen that there's actually a study that just came out a couple weeks ago that actually interviewed people of the public and, you know, posed to them some scenarios where scientists, you know, spoke out in public, made policy recommendations, actually showed that there's very little evidence to suggest that this causes you to lose credibility with the public either. So it's actually an interesting question, and it will be a question for another talk, about actually why we are so worried about this issue when there's actually so little evidence to support it. Okay, so part three, facts don't speak for themselves. Well, why do I say that? Why don't facts speak for themselves? Well, the simple answer, and when I started saying this 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, this was considered controversial. Now it seems obvious, so that's good. I can make the talk shorter. We live in a world where many people are trying to silence facts. And as you know, as many of us now understand, these arguments are not actually about the facts. They're not just about the facts, and in most cases, they're not even actually about the facts at all. Many of the arguments that are being used to undermine climate science, to be able to undermine evolution, to undermine vaccine safety, these are arguments about political beliefs, about economic interests, and about values. You cannot refute a claim about values with facts, or a claim about facts with values. That's what philosophers would call a category mistake, right? We're conflating two different domains. If people are rejecting climate science because of values, then we have to think about what those values are and why those values are perceived to be in conflict with our facts. And this was essentially the conclusion of the work I did with my colleague Eric Conway when we wrote the book Merchants of Doubt. When we started this project, we were frankly mystified. We had come across a story of some very famous scientists, scientists that we actually knew, one of whom had been the director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, where I was working at the time. And these prominent, distinguished, famous scientists had become climate change deniers. And there was no possibility that this was scientific illiteracy because these were some of the most brilliant and successful scientists of the 20th century. It included Frederick Seitz, who was the president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. So the question we had was, why would these people reject the scientific work of their own colleagues? How do you make sense of that? And what we found overwhelmingly, not just for these men that we studied in our book, but in general, that the rejection of climate scientific facts was not about scientific illiteracy or lack of scientific understanding, but actually it was driven by an anxiety, by a fear, by a worry. The worry that addressing climate change would lead to bigger government, higher taxes, and loss of personal freedom. And those concerns and the solutions that people were proposing for climate science were seen as clashing with conservative values. And that's why we've seen this enormous politicization of the issue, because of conservatives believing that the implications of climate science threaten their values. It's this clash of values, then, that explains the polarization and also some of the otherwise strange alliances that we see on this issue. The perception that addressing climate change will require big government or higher taxes explains a good deal of the political polarization around the issue, because opponents of big government are ideologically motivated to reject climate scientific evidence. And they've made common cause, then, with industries that reject the science because it threatens their profit. So the obvious part of this story, the economic motive, this economic self-interest, aligns with a more subtle and complicated story about people seeing climate science as clashing with and threatening their values.
That was the first part of a one-hour talk by Professor Naomi Oreskes. She spoke to her colleagues at Harvard on March 29, 2017. Come back for the conclusion when TUC Radio returns. Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard. She studied at the Royal School of Mines in England. Her best-known books are Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco to Global Warming, and her 2014 book, The Collapse of Western Civilization. TUC Radio is celebrating 25 years on the air. It's produced off the grid with solar power for the last 15 years. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The notion that evolution is based on more ruthlessly outcompeting your enemies, your competitors, I mean, that's nothing but corporate capitalism projected onto the natural world.
That's the voice of author Derek Jensen. On this week's show, Sylvia speaks to Derek Jensen regarding the contradictions between industrial capitalism and the environmental movement and who citizens should show solidarity with if we are to move society forward in a healthy way. So stay tuned.
We are very privileged to be joined by Derek Jensen. Derek Jensen is a prolific author. He is a philosopher, a teacher, and a radical activist, the winner of many awards. He's got several books, seven of which I've read. I'm very privileged to have him on my program today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, Derek, I feel that we live in a world that, you know, this notion of survival of the fittest sort of frames and legitimizes all kinds of oppression, imposing a natural, you know, administrative hierarchy, a political hierarchy that, you know, we are told we are all sort of consensus to, you know, we're all agreeing to this narrative that is founded on this naturalness that, you know, this is just how things are. Can we talk a little bit about what this hierarchy means to the living world when the voices of the rivers, the forests, the mountains are silenced when seen simply as resources?
Well, I think this is something that essentially every oppressive system attempts to do, is to naturalize its oppression so that it's inevitable. So it's not that the Nazis hated Jews. Instead, it's that from the perspective of the Nazis, they had themselves convinced that the Jews are actually inferior and need to be, in fact, they're a problem that needs to be solved. And thus, they're not actually committing atrocities, but they're doing everyone a favor by doing their behavior. And in fact, there were Nazis who, I don't remember who, if it was Himmler or someone, who talked about the great sacrifice that the Nazis were making in taking on this terrible task. So they were doing this great sacrifice by taking on this very difficult thing. So that's one example of it. Another example of it is, you know, the oppression of women, that men are naturally superior to women, or men are naturally better at certain things, which, what do you know, just end up being things for which you get paid a lot more. And, you know, we saw that with Lawrence Summers saying that the reason there aren't more women in math is because men's brains work better. We have different brains, and my brain just happens to work a little bit better than your brain that way. You know, it doesn't really matter whether you are talking about a god that just happens to look be of your gender and of your, you know, my gender, actually, and my race and my species, or whether we're talking about a selfish gene that makes it so we all act completely abominably and destroy communities. It's still naturalizing the oppression. You know, we talked about this before, that you know, in many ways, the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners would perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And, you know, I've been having this really interesting conversation recently with an epidemiologist about evolution and about viruses and about all sorts of really interesting things, that some of which I didn't know before. And he's a very, very smart person, and the one place where we're disagreeing so far is that he was saying to me that evolution can't think long-term, and it's all based on extreme short-term advantage. And I, of course, really disagree. That I think that those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, and you don't survive in the long run by destroying your surroundings. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. So I actually think that evolution is based on not survival of the fittest, but as Dolores Chappelle said, survival of the fit. It's how well you fit into your surroundings. So salmon make forests a better place simply by their existence. And it's a win-win situation for everybody. The salmon do better, the forests do better, everybody else, the bears do better, the insects do better, the ravens do better, the eagles do better, the bears do better. I don't know if I mentioned them already. The trees do better. And that's how evolution, I mean, how do we think that the world became so wild and fecund and gorgeous in the first place? It was through everybody living and dying and making the world a better place by their mere lives. But the notion that evolution is based on more ruthlessly outcompeting your enemies, your competitors, I mean, that's nothing but corporate capitalism projected onto the natural world. And once again, this is really, really important, because if the oppressors can get you to perceive the oppression as natural, or, and of course this was in slavery too, and it has been in slavery, that the reason it was okay for the whites to enslave the Africans was that, I mean, there were scientific reasons, there were biblical reasons, they had all sorts of justifications, all of which were, of course, nothing but justifications. Robert J. Lifton told me this great thing about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you're doing is actually a benefit. So like I said about the Nazis, they weren't actually killing Jews from their perspective. They weren't committing genocide. What they were doing is purifying the Aryan race, or what, you know, right now capitalists are not destroying the planet. They are developing natural resources. And, you know, there was an article recently about, titled, it was in some Southwestern newspaper, maybe the LA Times. It was titled, Destroying the Planet to Save It. And it was about putting in these huge solar fields in the desert, and how they were saying, gosh, it's so difficult because we have to, you know, we have to destroy this desert in order to save the planet. It's like, actually, no, because the electricity is being generated for industry. It's not being generated for the planet. You're not saving the planet.
I was just saying how beautiful the connections you make, because in many ways it's recognizing the inequality in our relationships that enables that kind of logic to permeate and to maintain this way of thinking. But I'm wondering if, you know, what if the purpose of our life is not to dominate? You know, if maybe just like nature, you know, we are also meant to coexist, you know, through reciprocity, through sharing and being, not adapting to new ways of harm and new ways of violence, but rather adapting to the limitations of our environment. Can you talk a little bit about what would a culture without this kind of administer violence that it's imposed through bureaucracies or whatever you want to call them? You know, there's all this institutionalized way of seeing ourselves and very rigid ways of knowing ourselves, because this is what science has told us or this is what school has told us. How do we break out of it? How do we reimagine ourselves? How do we remember what we have forgotten?
I think that there are as many ways to do that as there are individuals. And I don't know how you work, but a lot of times the way I change is through sort of an interplay of emotional experience and intellectual exploration, by which I mean, you know, I can get a feeling, you know, it's like something's not right. You know, this doesn't really make sense to me about the, you know, that I don't believe that all of life is this terrible competition. And so it's not setting right for me. So I need to think about it. And then I can articulate my way forward, and articulate, I read other people and I talk to people and I get a framework that starts to make more sense, and then I go out into the world and I test it to see if it makes sense, and I see how it feels, and then the feelings can catch up to the intellectualization, and then sometimes the feelings can move a little bit further out. It's like, okay, so now I'm comfortable with this. Now I can move it a little bit further out, and then further, and then further. So for me, it's a combination of experience and what feels right in my gut, and dreams. And, you know, I can have a dream that can help me I won't understand the dream, but it'll make like, oh, this makes more sense. And then I have to try to understand the dream, and reading, you know, purely intellectual or logical discussions can help me to then make sense of the non-logical dream. And so for me, it's that interplay. And then also, frankly, the bottom line for me is, you know, we talk, you know, to go back to that new friend that I'm having a discussion with about, who said that evolution doesn't think long-term and can't allow something to think long-term. I just look at the world and I look at the results. I mean, for me, I know this is an economic phrase, but it's always there. It's like, what's the bottom line? And the bottom line is this culture, this way of looking at the world is killing the planet. And that's obviously maladaptive. And so if it's maladaptive, it's probably wrong and probably factually inaccurate. You know, we have the Talawa Indians lived where I live now for at least 12,500 years. And, you know, sort of a scientific mechanist or mechanistic scientist could say, well, gosh, they, you know, they were obviously, when they did salmon welcoming songs, the salmon couldn't hear the songs. They could say, you know, if they were singing to the salmon or praying to the salmon or praying about the salmon, that was all nonsense. But the truth is, they lived here for 12,500 years, and the place was a paradise. And the dominant culture has been here for less than 200 years, and the place is trashed. So, and you then have the gall to say that their perspective is wrong? Well, this perspective is maladaptive. You know, I read this really interesting, I was reading about plant intelligence recently, and you know, I've thought about this a lot over the years. I was thinking more about it. So there's some really cool stuff I'm reading. And one thing I was reading was saying that the best definition of intelligence is to figure out actions. I mean, how do my actions now affect my future well-being? And these people are using those as definitions of intelligence. And on those definitions, plants are intelligent, that they will make. It's very interesting stuff. Plants will make decisions as to where to branch out based on future conditions in the forest as to where the branch would be most effective. So they can predict where the sun is going to be in a few years and grow a branch out to that place. They're actually making decisions, once again, based on, and there are plants that decide to bloom or not bloom. Some of them that bloom very frequently can make those decisions years in advance based on conditions. So it's very interesting stuff. And then I'm contrasting that to myself, and I'm thinking, okay, my grandfather had diabetes, and he died of bladder cancer because of eating artificial sweetener every day. Back in the 60s, he died. And my mom has diabetes, and so I knew that I had a genetic predisposition to diabetes. And did that stop me from eating four baked potatoes at every meal? Did that stop me from eating bunches of ice cream through my 30s? Did this stop me from? And then I recently was diagnosed with diabetes, and it's like, wow, I was not actually showing any native intelligence. You know, we determine intelligence by whether current actions are going to determine future well-being. And, you know, honestly, when I look around, you know, I don't see under this definition, the dominant culture is really not, I'm not seeing any signs of intelligence whatsoever, frankly.
Yeah. You know, I was reading the book The Price of Inequality, and the writer points out that not only is this idea that we're doing better is you know, flawed, because in many ways, when they do all kinds of expectancy research, life expectancy, for instance, in the U.S. is 78 years compared to 83 in Japan or Australia. And the U.S. comes 40th, just below Cuba. You know, infant mortality is still higher in the U.S. than in other developing countries. And so we have to ask the question, where is this industrialized culture leading us to, when what we see is the constant promotion and maintenance of a culture of violence. You know, so I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the relationship between the capitalist system then and the world that it's intent on living on the principle of coexistence, of reciprocity. Can the two coexist? The evidence so far, I would argue, is no. So how do we move away and create new relationships?
I was kind of hoping that you would end your question with, is capitalism compatible with that, you know, either life-affirming or reciprocal relationships? And I was going to then just, because we've done a lot of interviews, I was going to sort of tease you by giving the answer that is every interviewer's nightmare, which is no, and then just shut up. And, you know, they're not compatible, and just leave it at that. But you went on to ask the more difficult question, which is, what do we do about that? How do we, I mean, part of what we have to do is, I was talking to a friend of mine today who is a doctor who, one of the things he's also an environmentalist, and one of the things he says all the time is there is a standard protocol when you're doing medicine, which is the first step, correct prognosis is the first step toward effective treatment, a first step toward cure. And I think that one of the things we have to do is to do the correct prognosis. And as he said when I was talking to him today, you have to take a history, you have to look at what the current situation is. And this is one of the things that, I mean, Paul Kingsnorth talks about how there's a real problem with a lot of environmentalism these days, because he asks, when did environmentalism become not about protecting wild places, but instead about finding ways to make capitalism last longer? And I think that's a tremendous point, and it's very, very important. And when people talk about sustainable capitalism, I think that those people have a lot to answer for, because they're completely wrong and they're pushing us into dead ends. And it's the same when people talk about, you know, sustainable wind energy. I mean, industrialism, civilization itself, but especially industrialism, has never been sustainable and will never be sustainable and can never be sustainable on a functional level. If this culture is killing the planet, the least we can do is tell the truth. And so a lot of environmentalists are lying to us, are lying to all of us, and they're lying to themselves. And that's not helpful. It's not helpful. It's not helpful on a personal level. You know, I've got Crohn's disease, and I could pretend, I could say, oh, I don't really have a disease. I just have diarrhea that goes on and on and on. And that's not helpful. That's not helpful at all. In fact, it's really harmful.
In your book, The End Game, Volume 1, you actually tell us exactly your premises for the book. And one of them, premise 14, you talk about that how from birth on, you know, we are enculturated into this, you know, this notion of hate, you know, for life, to hate the natural world, hate the wild, hate the animals, hate women, hate children, hate our bodies. We've been living in a culture that rather than face that diagnosis of not just the symptoms of hate, you know, the symptoms of embodying violence as part of the culture, but the actual cause that permeates that culture. And you say that, you know, to love does not imply pacifism. What do you mean by that? And because I think that love has always been proposed as the solution to all our problems. Mandela loved the world, and so he forgave. But no one asked why we didn't forgive the debt of the South African people, and so giving them an equal footing. No one asks, you know, why we don't forgive, you know, the debts of other countries. And so, to me, this simplified notion of just love and things will right themselves doesn't seem to do it. So can we talk in close? And we only have about 4 minutes, but if you could.
Well, I think it depends on what we mean by love. I mean, when I think about love, I think about a mother bear. And if someone were to, what would happen if there's a baby bear, and there's a mother bear right next to it? What would happen to you if you walked in and started punching the baby bear in the face? What do you think the mother bear would do?
Well, I think that a mother bear would attack me if I attacked his baby.
So does that mean that the mother bear doesn't love her child? I mean, for me, love implies that you're going to act to defend your beloved. And if you don't act to defend your beloved, under many circumstances, I don't know that that's love. And the reason I have to put in the weasel words about under many circumstances is I am not implying that, you know, a woman who was in World War II, who was standing next to her child, who was faced with SS machine guns, needs to rush them. I mean, there may be nothing she can do at that point except for hold her child and attempt to give the child a lifetime's worth of love in 5 seconds. That's very possible, too. And I know that there were American Indians who I'm thinking of specifically of some Central and South American ones who were being enslaved by the Spanish, and what they would do is the mothers would take their children and they would jump off a cliff with their children because they didn't want their children sent to the mines. And that can be an act of love too. But the point is that much of the problem is we don't perceive the world as existing. We don't perceive octopi as being wonderful, beautiful, extraordinary beings with lives just as precious to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. It's like every single, makes me so angry. Every single article that I read about some species going extinct has to immediately switch over to the economic effects of this. But it's so narcissistic and so dreadful. There are lots of articles about how the oceans are acidifying, and within one sentence, they always have to jump over to, wow, this is really harmful for the aquaculture, for the oyster farms that are in the ocean. It's like, forget the oyster farms. This is the whole ocean we're talking about. This is life on this planet. And so what I mean by all that, love does not imply pacifism, is everything in this culture teaches us to identify with the oppressors, and what we're supposed to do is to love our enemies. Well, screw that. What we need to do first is love the victims. And if there's any love left over, once you love the victims, then that can go over to the oppressors or to anybody else. But actually, frankly, I'm not cared about, you know, it's a bit late in the game to be worried about the emotional well-being of those who are killing the planet. Once again, my loyalty is 100% with the victims of this culture. And you know, so many indigenous people have said to me, it's the first and most important thing that we need to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And part of what that includes is breaking your identification and your loyalty with the system and making your identification with the victims of the culture, with the oppressed. And once you do that, everything else starts to fall into place.
Thank you so much. That was beautiful. My guest is Derek Jensen. His book, he's got many books. You can read his reader, the Derek Jensen reader. But tell our audience very quickly in 2 seconds how they can access your books, how they can reach your work.
Well, I've got a website, derekjensen.org, DerikJensen.org. And the book should be available anywhere. And thank you. You always ask such wonderful questions. I'm always honored to be on your program.
Thank you again for being with us.
To finish out the show, I'm going to play a short clip by Noam Chomsky, which closely relates to the interview that Sylvia just did with Derek Jensen.
Modern industrial civilization has developed within a certain system of convenient myths. The driving force of modern industrial civilization has been individual material gain, which is accepted as legitimate, even praiseworthy, on the grounds that private vices yield public benefits in the classic formulation. Now, it's long been understood very well that a society that is based on this principle will destroy itself in time. It can only persist with whatever suffering and injustice it entails as long as it's possible to pretend that the destructive forces that humans create are limited, that the world is an infinite resource, and that the world is an infinite garbage can. At this stage of history, either one of two things is possible. Either the general population will take control of its own destiny and will concern itself with community interests, guided by values of solidarity and sympathy and concern for others, or alternatively, there will be no destiny for anyone to control. As long as some specialized class is in a position of authority, it is going to set policy in the special interests that it serves. But the conditions of survival, let alone justice, require rational social planning in the interests of the community as a whole, and by now that means the global community. The question is whether privileged elites should dominate mass communication and should use this power as they tell us they must, namely to impose necessary illusions, to manipulate and deceive the stupid majority and remove them from the public arena. The question, in brief, is whether democracy and freedom are values to be preserved or threats to be avoided. In this possibly terminal phase of human existence, democracy and freedom are more than values to be treasured. They may well be essential to survival. Thank you.
come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.